Whether or not there are any precedents for what resident doctors warn us is happening to their profession. If serious change is not made, if pay increases are not delivered and major changes to some of the training conditions and contracts, then the entire profession could be, if not sunk below the waterline, then certainly nobbled or hobbled. And I couldn't think of anything. And then as I came down this corridor towards the studio, and I heard Nick and his callers talking about dentistry. And I found myself thinking, well, when I was a kid, I'm pretty sure that dentistry was pretty efficient, pretty straightforward. Should we heed the resident doctor's warnings more?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, authorities in Australia are investigating a trip the Bondi Beach gunman made to the Philippines last month. 15 people were killed when father and son Sajid and Navid Akram targeted a Hanukkah event on Sunday. Searchers have uncovered explosives and homemade IS flags. There are reports they travelled aboard for training. Australian students Wilson and Josh joined a vigil for the victims in Westminster last night.
It was just shocking to see some place that I'm so familiar with be desecrated in such a way. I'm quite shaken up.
You would never think something so crazy and so such an act of violence would happen in a place that I'm also so familiar with.
A government minister says the BBC should stand firm in the face of a lawsuit from Donald Trump. He is suing the broadcaster for $10 billion for selectively editing one of his speeches in an episode of Panorama. The BBC has previously apologised but said there is no basis for the claim. Official figures show another weakening in the jobs market, with unemployment at 5.1% in the 3 months to October. Wage growth also fell back to 4.6% but remains ahead of inflation. Analysts say that strengthens the case for an interest rate cut from the Bank of England later this week. The former Health Secretary, Alan Milburn, has warned there is a real risk of a lost generation in Britain. He is beginning an investigation into the causes of high levels of unemployment and inactivity in young people. It'll look at the causes of growing inactivity among 16 to 24-year-olds. Mr. Milburn's told LBC that radical and sometimes uncomfortable solutions are needed.
We know that there's about 1 million young people. The numbers have been rising. Unemployment figures are out today, and unfortunately, we're in the middle of a perfect storm, as you know, with really since the pandemic, the rates of employment amongst young people have been falling. The rates of unemployment has been rising. So something is going on in the youth labour market.
Doctors' leaders have rejected claims that patients will lose their lives as a result of this week's strike in England. A BMA deputy chair told LBC that deaths could actually go down during the walkout because consultants will be providing cover. The five-day strike is due to begin early tomorrow morning. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 97.38. That's down 13. The pound buys $1.33 and the euro 13. LBC weather still quite foggy, then a dry day with plenty of sunshine for many. Cloudier with some patchy rain in the south. East, a high of 12 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
This Christmas at Tesco, get a sharing bag of Doritos Chilli Heatwave for just £1.45, down from £2.50 with your Tesco Club card. Finding great prices, that's what makes it Christmas. Tesco, every little helps. Majority of large stores, Doritos 180 grams and 2nd of January. Club card or app required.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after ten. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. That might have been a little bit bonkers. I never know whether it's exciting or dangerous when a thought occurs to me as I come through the studio door and Nick Ferrari is still talking. And I think, oh yes, that's a very insightful observation, James. You must share that immediately. But I do think, and I've sort of checked my memory banks and with a couple of colleagues, that when I was younger, dentistry was fit for purpose. The idea of a radio phone-in or a news story detailing the difficulties, nigh on the impossibility of getting an NHS dentist, and the rarity of NHS dentists undertaking emergency surgery or emergency operations, which is in the news today as they plan changes to the system that would sort of make it more attractive for them to do so. I'm pretty sure that didn't happen. I know Americans like to laugh at us for having awful teeth, but I think we were definitely NHS when I was a kid. I definitely wasn't receiving private dental health. It was my friend's dad was our dentist, actually. And I'm pretty sure it was largely fit for purpose. I don't think I'm going wrong, because I can't imagine that Kidderminster was going through a golden age of dentistry while the rest of the country was suffering from untold cavities and tooth decay. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty good, right? And then you fast forward. I don't know who is responsible, whether it was the Labour government that was in power till 2010 or the government that came after that, or possibly even the government that came before that. But there were some fairly profound changes to dentistry, to how dentist surgeries are run, to how dentists do their thing. And from where I am sitting today, things have got much worse, not much better. That's not the phone in, by the way. That's just a sort of observation. Because what I was trying to think of was an example of people in a profession, ideally a public sector profession, but not necessarily, people in a profession who warned us that they were circling the plug hole, or they were in danger of major systemic and even existential decline. So they come to you and they say, sorry, they come to us and they say, please support us as we resist this government, because if we do not get some of what we're asking for, then our entire profession will be compromised, will be diminished, will decline. And you absolutely should care about that, because, ideally, it is a public service and you are a member of the public. It's funny, isn't it? One thing we've all got in common, right? And I can say this with supreme confidence. We are all members of the public. Every single one of us. And we are all humans. And yet the direction of political traffic in much of the Western world at the moment is attacking rights for humans, or human rights, as they're often called, and the public sector. Or areas of our economy that are ring fenced because of their intrinsic essentialness to the public good. But if you're a member of the public and or you're a human, spoiler alert, you are both. You're being softened up at the moment to resist legislation and movements that recognise and reward people for being human or for being members of the public. Anyway, I digress, because the doctor's story is obviously where my brain is bouncing at the moment, and the confusion I have really over whether or not I support this. Yeah, probation officers, prison officers. I don't want to make any enemies, but minors, I think that's a slightly different suggestion, albeit that Margaret Thatcher was perfectly happy to contemplate the complete destruction of the mining industry. It was a political decision. So while the miners might have warned about it, it wasn't that we would all suffer as a consequence of the mining industry declining. I mean, it left parts of the country in a parlous state. But yeah, I guess in the sense of them saying, you don't understand, they want us to be destroyed, we should perhaps have paid a little bit more attention, because we didn't actually think, or a lot of people didn't actually think, Arthur Scargill certainly didn't actually think, that they would preside over the complete destruction of the coal mining industry. Prison officers and probation officers, they warned us in no uncertain terms when Chris Grayling was in charge of their profession that changes were being done to the profession that would render it much, much less fit for purpose. I don't know whether or not the increasing popularity of prisoners being released by accident is a consequence of changes that Chris Grayling brought in. I don't know whether, and this might just be my morning reading, there seems to be an awful lot of young ladies having sexual relationships with prisoners at the moment. There's another one in the newspaper today. Well, I say posing provocatively. That's almost certainly not fair, because I imagine someone's just pulled a picture down from her Facebook page or her social media. But I don't remember that being quite a commonplace occurrence when I was young. But, you know, we were told repeatedly by prison officers, and particularly by probation officers, that changes being made to their profession would be to the public ill, to the public harm. Anyone want to argue with them now, retrospectively? Anyone want to tell prison officers and probation officers that they should give their heads a wobble and apologise for warning us about what might be on the horizon? Anything else? And any other areas where the people in the profession warned us about what was happening? Could you put teaching on the list? We may talk again about NEETs later in the programme because of Alan Milburn's latest intervention. Could you put teachers on the list when they warned us about children being reduced to sort of grade farms by Michael Gove's introductions, by Michael Gove's policies, and of course Dominic Cummings at his side, like a sort of diabolical Robin to the world's worst Batman? Were we wrong not to pay more heed to teachers when they warned us what was happening? Is the explosion in young people in neither education, employment, nor training in some way linked to what happened during their conventional schooling, as opposed to the very unconventional impact of COVID and the pandemic and the lockdowns? I don't know. I genuinely don't know, but it's a thought. I don't think anyone would argue with prison officers and probation officers. I don't think that anyone would argue with dentists, although I can't say for certain that dentists were screaming from the rooftops to warn us about what was happening to their profession. If they were, I may have forgotten or I may have missed it at the time. But I am a naive soul, as you know, and I used to think, I probably still do, but this argument isn't quite as watertight as I thought it was at the time, that when my children were at primary school, my children were at state primary school, and some of their teachers went on strike. And I remember thinking, how can I not trust them with their reasoning in this? Firefighters is a good example, perhaps, actually, that they were warning us about what was happening to their profession. Again, a public sector profession. It's almost as if right-wing politicians see a public sector profession and think there is a fat cat that needs trimming, rather than looking at actual fat cats and deciding to take some of the fat from them. Police have probably warned us. I remember when this is quite fertile ground, isn't it? Do you remember when Theresa May stood up in front of the Police Federation and literally accused them of scaremongering for explaining that having fewer police officers would mean that fewer crimes got solved? Could you imagine? Just pause for a minute, because that's a moment of quite spectacular beauty from a woman who I think is treated rather too kindly by history. Theresa May literally stood up in front of the Police Federation and told police officers to stop scaremongering by explaining or arguing that reducing the number of police officers on our streets, or indeed in our country, would reduce their capacity to apprehend criminals or solve crimes. Extraordinary, really. That was another bonus, another upshot of austerity. So the list is getting longer, and the argument that we probably should have listened to them a little bit more closely and ignored right-wing voices telling us that their complaints were ill-founded or their industrial action, in some cases, the firefighters, not the police, was unjustified. And then, you know, fast forward 5, 10, 15 years, and it turns out that they were right, and their professions have been, if not decimated, then certainly damaged. So I used to think when I dropped the girls off at primary school, I never dropped them off, did I? Because I was too busy coming to entertain you every morning. But when I picked them up from primary school and strikes were imminent, or some teachers had gone on strike, so the whole day had been changed. Armed forces, sorry, I keep distracting myself. Well, you keep distracting me. We learned yesterday from the head of MI6 that we're already at war with Russia. And military top brass have been warning for years that we were diminishing our capacity to defend ourselves at a time when everybody was wrongly convinced we were absolutely safe and peaceful. Again, because I think you expect it from me, the Tories were turning up in the Russian ambassador's garden to launch the Conservative Friends of Israel when the Kremlin was already embarked upon a plan to completely undermine Western democracy by putting absolute Herberts and traitors at the very heart of our politics. So, yeah, we should have listened to the soldiers. So that's the list. We should have listened to the prisoners. We should have listened to the probation officers. We should have listened to the firefighters. We should have listened to the police officers. We should have listened to the soldiers. And we probably should have listened to the police, to the teachers. So should we listen to the doctors? 0345 6060 973. I would quite like to hit 11 o'clock today persuaded that I'm on the doctor's side. I've tried not to be. I've argued against it. I thought perhaps last week Wes Streeting had played a blinder by addressing some of the current concerns that resident doctors brought to me. But the numbers, the mandate, which we had a little look at yesterday, really didn't exactly stop me in my tracks, but it did make me think. And it made me think that I would trust these people with my life. Just hold that thought. I would trust these people with my life. I would trust these people with my children's lives, my wife's life, my mother's life, my sister's life. I would trust these people with my life. I might not have a huge choice in the matter. It's not as if you can shop around or invite tenders and bids for life-saving operation. But and, of course, no profession is perfect and no individual is perfect either. But I would trust these people with my life. So why should I not trust them when they tell me that they feel they have no choice but to go on strike? Turnout 65%, success rate, positive votes 83%. Keir Starmer describes himself as being gutted by the result. Another reminder that he, unlike many politicians, is a genuine football fan. And less impressively, perhaps, describes it as irresponsible given the rising pressure from flu. Now, sometimes when I tell you that the people undertaking industrial action should be more deserving of our support, you tell me that they're all a bunch of communists. Well, you don't really tell me that anymore. Those days, I think, sadly have passed. But there'll be somebody writing for the usual newspapers or posting online or recording a TikTok video insisting that all the doctors are communists. They're all terrible lefties and they'll be happy when we're dead and various other lies or conspiracy theories or exhalations of absolute bonkersness. You can't really do that with the doctors, I don't think. I think, for example, you would struggle to argue that doctors were either A, class warriors, B, communists, or C, dedicated to the destruction of the capitalist state. You couldn't really do that with police officers, prison officers, probation officers, or soldiers either, but it didn't stop people trying. Teachers seem to be on the hook for that accusation, don't they, more than almost anybody else these days. But you wouldn't, I don't think, argue that doctors are any of those things. And the support for the strike is very high. An online poll with a turnout of 65% strikes me as really remarkable. I don't think there's been a general election with turnout that high in our lifetime, has there? So certainly for a second poll on an established mandate, because they had a look at the deal that Wes Streeting had offered, and they didn't change their mind. They didn't blink. 83% of its members who voted to continue with the walkout. They are adamant. That is an extraordinary level of support for a strike. And it's going ahead at a time when many people are warning the flu pandemic is causing the NHS major, major problems. I don't dispute that, by the way. But this is the question I want you to answer. You would trust them with your life. So why wouldn't you trust them on this? And that question swerves the pay rise, doesn't it? You say, well, no one else in the public sector has got a 29% pay rise. Why are they going on strike? But listen, they know they've got a 29% pay rise. They know that. That's not news. That's not something you're bringing to the table like some sort of rhetorical zinger that will make the resident doctors suddenly go, oh, yeah, I forgot about the pay rise. Yeah, I don't want to go on strike, actually. So they accepted that pay rise. They argue persuasively with evidence that they're still not enjoying parity with the wages that they would have expected to be on had their wages kept track with inflation since about 2008. So that's not quite the deal breaker that I used to think it was. It's just evidence that they are still worried about the future of their profession, the future of themselves. So I think, and we may broaden it a little, but I'd like to start with that question. If we would trust them with our lives, shouldn't we trust them when they tell us they have no choice but to go on strike this week? Tell me the logical, philosophical, moral or rhetorical flaws in that position. Or, of course, tell me why you agree. I trust these men and women with my life. I trust them with my children's lives. How can I not trust them when they tell me that they feel they have to go on strike? Riddle me that on 0345 6060 973. It's 10:18.
LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
The new single drops. The world tour begins. And our
artists create the music we love, you could be right there in the mix. Calling all young creatives. If you want a career in music, then listen up. Global Academy have a new 6-4 music production course. State-of-the-art studios, practical experience, hands-on learning with music professionals. Awesome. Apply now at globalacademy.com.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including Well Man, Well Woman, Well Baby and Well Kid. From Boots, Pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
Take the world's best snooker players. One of the most unpredictable seasons. At the electric atmosphere of Alexandra Palace. It can only be the 2026. Johnston's Paint Masters. Could it be Sean Murphy, Judd Trump, Neil Robertson, or world champion Zhaozing Tong who takes the trophy? One thing's certain, nothing beats the Johnston's Paint Masters live. Enjoy our biggest ever fan zone. Watch in style from VIP sofas. Book now, wst.tv/tickets.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
20 minutes after 10 is the time. I should have mentioned at the outset that Donald Trump yesterday delivered what I think might be the single most disgusting contribution to public discourse he's made in his life, let alone in his term, his second term as president, or either of his two terms as president. And in the context of the apparent murder of the film director Rob Reiner and his wife, and their son is now in custody, Donald Trump took to social media. Can you still be shocked by him? If you'd asked me yesterday morning, this time yesterday, could you still be shocked by Donald Trump, James? I'd have thought about it, because I always take your questions seriously. I'd have thought about it, and I'd have said, I don't know that I can. I might be shocked by events, you know, if details emerge in the Epstein thing, I'll be shocked but not surprised. But can you be both shocked and surprised by anything that Donald Trump does? I think I might have said no. And then he weighed in on the murder of Rob Reiner and Michelle Reiner. And I'll share the details of that with you later if you haven't seen it already. There may be a phone-in in it. I haven't decided yet. I'll find out what you think. But at the moment, I want to know what you think about the doctor's strike. And I don't think this is a watertight zinger, but I think it might focus your mind. You trust them with your life. And I don't, listen, as Tony points out, we don't have an awful lot of choice in that process. And as Jamie points out, you trust a plumber with your pipes, but not necessarily your political insights. But if a plumber told you that my ability to look after your pipes is going to be severely compromised unless the government meets us halfway on our demands, you'd pay a little bit more attention than you would if he was just shouting it from the rooftops, right? And the doctors are saying our ability to look after your pipes, metaphorically speaking, is being compromised. And that long list of public sector workers who've told us similar previously and turned out to be right means, in my humble opinion, we should be paying a little bit more attention, perhaps, than most of the media wants us to. Andy's in Grays. Andy, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. Yeah, so I'm a nurse. I work in intensive care. I work in a specialist intensive care. And so I'm extremely strike adjacent. I see it very yes. closely. Also, intensive care, for those people who work in medical professions, we work extremely close with the doctors, perhaps closer than other departments, except for maybe A&E.
Okay.
So can I just quickly tell you about my day last Thursday when there was no strike?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I come onto shift. I'm looking after patient one, sickest patient on the unit, actively dying. We're doing our best for him. I'm trying to keep him alive until the family get there. Meanwhile, we get word that patient two is going to come from the ward extremely sick. So my colleague immediately tried to discharge the two healthiest patients on the ward.
Right.
They weren't healthy enough to go, but they were the two healthiest. So my colleague goes off. My patient one's family get there. Patient two comes down to us, immediately has a cardiac arrest. So I've got one patient here who I'm trying to keep alive so the family can say their goodbyes. I've got a second patient who's in cardiac arrest.
Flipping it.
There's one doctor trying to deal with that. Meanwhile, the other doctor is trying to frantically deal with the discharges and see all the other patients on the unit to ensure they're safe. We get that patient back, patient two. In the meantime, following patient two, getting settled, we're all sorted. Patient one passes away. I have to deal with all the administration regarding that. I'm then getting an emergency admission from theatre of a patient who's actively bleeding, very, very sick. Patient three comes out, and I'm giving countless blood products, and obviously you can see what's coming. Patient two has a cardiac arrest while patient three is bleeding. Yeah. There's no doctors at the time because they're trying to deal with elsewhere, putting lines in, dealing with all sorts of things. So we have to deal with the cardiac arrest for patient two whilst patient three is bleeding. There was no strikes that day. Yeah. This is a normal day in the NHS, and all of my medical colleagues will understand this. And in the meantime, my doctor colleagues are not only looking after the intensive care on my floor, they're looking after the whole specialist centre, which is three other wards. So they're dealing with sick patients on the wards, they're trying to deal with admissions to us, they're trying to deal with our sick patients over and over again. And that was just a completely normal day. So I finished the day with two having died, and one who was ropey, and the third one was fine in the end, but extremely busy. And I get home, and after 15 hours, and I can barely move. Now, obviously, that's a nurse's perspective, but my doctor colleagues will have the same perspective. So your producer said to me on the phone, why should we trust them with our lives? I think for people sitting there writing comments in the Telegraph comment section, yeah, it's not acute enough for them, because it's not their mum or their dad right now in those positions. I promise you, every single person I see, when a doctor is standing over the head of their bed with a tube in their hand, ready to put it down their throat, put them to sleep because they are so sick, they require intubation, and the doctor said to them, look, you may not survive this procedure, but this is your only chance of survival. Every single person puts their trust in that doctor in that moment.
And just to be annoying, I did take a call last time round, or in a previous round of striking by resident doctors, or junior doctors as they were known then, from someone who had visited their mum in hospital, who was not actually in the position that you described, but she rang in almost not to poke fun at her mum, but to point out just how completely the Daily Mail can boil someone's brain. She was sitting in her hospital bed reading the Daily Mail and maligning the junior doctors who were looking after her, or would be looking after her, when they got to the end of their industrial action. So it's not 100% true that everybody who has direct frontline experience of medical care is going to be sympathetic to the resident doctors. But tell me why this is relevant to what I'm talking about today. I'm not being thick. Well, if I am, I'm sorry. But it, you're describing difficulties that the doctors have doing their job, and you're describing, yeah, a very overstretched NHS. As I understand it, what they're asking the government for currently would not alleviate much or any of what you're describing, would it?
Well, what they're asking for is a significant increase in training places. They're asking for prioritisation of UK graduates, so we're not having the medical market flooded by people who haven't trained here,
yes,
over people who have trained here.
But your Thursday hasn't changed. I'm going to be a little bit, if you don't mind, I'm going to be a bit robust with you. And I'm going to pick these points off one by one, and I'm going to get you to explain to me how that would have changed your Thursday.
It would have changed my... If you speak to doctors who are in training, there are significant bottlenecks everywhere in the system.
Yes.
Significant, especially at my understanding is that getting a consultant post, there's an enormous bottleneck. So if the government don't open the training places for these doctors who want the training places, there aren't the people to come and work on my unit.
Yeah, but that's not happening yet. There's no shortage. Is there a shortage on your unit? Are there unfilled posts?
There's shortages everywhere. This is what I'm saying. There isn't the funding. You can't just appoint a consultant to a position. There has to be funding for these positions. And if you look at the squeeze on funding in all sorts of roles, I know that there's a lot in nursing, especially there's a recruitment freeze literally happening at the moment, where newly qualified nurses can't get jobs.
This is really important. So I am on the ward. I'm with you. And we need a doctor now. And we can't get one when we want one because there are unfilled posts in that hospital.
Well, we obviously they have consultant cover. I'm talking about the ratios of consultant to sick patient.
You would like them to be lower, those ratios.
Correct, yeah. Because
and when were they last lower?
I mean, not since I've been a nurse.
Your Thursday, and again, I warned you I was going to be robust, and I think I'm on your side, but your Thursday hasn't changed.
But I don't quite agree that because it was bad 3 years ago, I don't quite agree that...
Have you only been a nurse for 3 years?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So, that changes my position slightly. I thought if it had been 20 years, it would be a slightly more powerful. I don't know if people listening can feel the improvements that would be made to the scenario you have described very powerfully by giving resident doctors a pay rise, because Wes Streeting, as I understand it, did pledge to increase speciality training posts and did pledge to address things like exam fees and other expenses. So arguably I'm more confused than I was at the beginning of last week, at the beginning of this week.
What I'm saying is that these people deserve a pay rise because of the level of responsibility for what they're dealing with. The reason why they deserve a pay rise is you have to have it all at the same time. You have to have the training places.
And to the people who say they just got 29%, Andy.
The point, if you break that down and you go and look at the numbers, over the 4 years that doctors got 29%, which no one says in the media, inflation was at 22%. So for that whole time, they actually got a 7% pay increase over 4 years. When you break it down and look at what they actually received. Now, 10, 15, 20 years ago, people would say to doctors, suck it up for 10, 15 years, you'll be a consultant soon. Right. Now that's gone as well. So now their pay has been squeezed at the same time as their progression has been squeezed. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And obviously you're closer to the action than I am, and that last bit of your contribution has cleared up some of the clouds for me. And it leads you to a position, which we should just clarify before you go, because it's time for the news, that you're in full support of your resident doctor colleagues.
100% support them fully.
So how can you not be? How can you not be? Apart from texts about 29% pay rises that ignore some of the financial and economic detail that Andy has just described. Phone lines are open. 0345 6060973 is the number you need. I worry sometimes that if you are... Well, I don't know. Should I worry about this? And if you are just sending me texts saying, 29%, can I have that, please? You don't... I hope this doesn't sound rude, but you haven't made any effort whatsoever to understand anything. You've just been bamboozled by this figure. You don't understand its relevance to what they were on in 2008. You don't understand its relevance to inflation. You don't understand why parity with what you would have expected to be earning now is something that should be fought for tooth and nail. So, but, you know, you've read your right-wing newspapers, and you've concluded that now doctors don't deserve your support. Just ask yourself this and ring me. Tell me why I'm wrong. 0345 6060973. Is there anybody that you couldn't be persuaded to oppose by right-wing media? Because the teachers who look after your children's future, the doctors who look after your children's lives and your lives, the police officers who are there to protect us from harm, and I appreciate if you've got an institutionally racist police service, then your relationship, if you are from an ethnic minority, is going to be different in many ways than mine, but the point stands. The firefighters who will literally run towards your burning home as you run out of it. We have been successfully turned against every single one of those professions in the course of my radio career. In the time that I've been doing this job, teachers, down with them. Police officers, shut up, suck it up. Doctors, oh, get lost, why should you get more? Prison officers, probation officers, police officers. They managed to turn you against absolutely every single professional who has dedicated their working life to looking after you. So is there anybody that you couldn't be persuaded to oppose when they tell you that they need more from their employer? In this case, the government? Genuine question. Thomas Watts has your headlines.
Counter-terror police in Australia are looking into reports the Bondi Beach gunman received training in the Philippines. 15 people were killed when father and son Sajid and Navid Akram targeted a Hanukkah event on Sunday. Britain's jobs market showed further signs of weakening in the lead-up to last month's budget. Official figures show the unemployment rate rose to 5.1%, its highest level since early 2021. Ministers will consider reforming the licence fee as part of the renewal process of the BBC's charter. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy's, opened a once-in-a-decade review of the broadcaster's governance. LBC weather, dry with sunshine for most places, cloudier with patchy rain in the southeast, a high of 12 degrees.
This is LBC.
When you buy a BMW-approved used electric car, there are no surprises. You'll find the largest range and the widest choice. Naturally, every car has been meticulously checked by qualified BMW technicians. Hardly a plot twist. And they always come with a battery health report and at least 12 months unlimited mileage BMW warranty. Just as you'd expect. BMW approved used electric cars. Nothing new here. Search BMW approved used electric. Obviously.
You know, sometimes you just want to mosey. Travel your own world. Slow things down a mite. meet the locals, and smell the coffee. So friends, take time to sit down with the folks at Little America and let them tailor-make your trip to Canada and the U.S. just the way you like it. For slow travel that nourishes the soul, head to littleamerica.co.uk.
I know every year it's the same. The ones you love most you leave until last. I just struggle to put into words how much you mean to me. Your hugs feel different to everyone else's. Your words hit harder. Your brew tastes better. But how can I say all that?
This Christmas, if you can't find the words, find the gift. John Lewis. Order by 12 p.m. on the 23rd to click and collect from John Lewis and Waitrose stores on Christmas Eve. Terms, conditions and exclusions apply.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to just say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
If only there was a way that could work with your advertising campaign. Well, there is. And you're listening to it. Because when you amplify your advertising with radio, 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 10:35. No offence to Ian, but he has just sent in the message that almost word for word typifies the position I just suggested might involve not a lot of thinking about things. James, you justify being on the side of the people who are refusing to go to work when there's a massive flu problem and they just had a 20-something percent pay rise. Yeah, I know. Sounded like Little Britain there, didn't I? Yeah, and all. But it is, I mean, they've been on strike a lot since 2023, and they remain committed to industrial action, an extraordinary level of support for it. And you have to stop and wonder whether we should be paying more attention to what they have to say. Dr. Jack Fletcher, who I think is head of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee, described what Andy was just describing to us as a repurposing of existing locally employed doctors. So this so-called bottleneck, training bottleneck, where unemployed doctors, of whom there are about 40,000. I need to speak to an unemployed doctor. 0345 6060 973. I need to understand this better. Okay? How can we have unemployed doctors? Seriously, 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need. 40,000 of you competing for 10,000 places to train in your chosen specialist area. So that might be psychiatry, A and E, or surgery. What happens if you don't get into your chosen specialist area? Do you become a GP, or do you become something else? You leave medicine. I genuinely don't know. So what? Explain that bottleneck to me, please. I also wonder how, and again, I don't want to sound rude, but how well-informed the resident doctors are. So you will know the reality of your own situation, but the relationship between the settlement you accepted and inflation, when the head of the committee, Dr. Jack Fletcher, describes this as a sort of form of rearranging the deck chairs that isn't going to make any meaningful improvement at all, the lack of training places being a result of political choices, not to fund or staff the NHS properly. That's the bit that chills me. A political choice not to fund the NHS properly. Trying to save money everywhere, trying to make money or raise money everywhere, NHS training places being a spot where we can save money by bringing in a lot of foreign doctors, foreign trained doctors. I've got no problem with their ethnic or geographical origins, but I quite like the idea of British medical students joining the British NHS, seeing that path ahead of them, being clear and attractive. And if it is less clear and attractive now than it should or could be, I need you to explain it to me. I need you to, because it's almost like there's a bit of a disconnect. Public support for the strike has come down. It was quite high to start with, while doctor support for the strike is more or less unchanged. And that means there's a communication failure here, in that the average punter doesn't fully understand the average resident doctor. And I wonder if we can do something to fix that together today. James is in Hounslow. James, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Thanks for taking the call. I think I could really explain the whole unemployed doctors thing if you'd like me to.
I would love you to, yes.
So I'm a resident doctor. I'm 2 years out of university and my third year as being a doctor.
You're not at West Mid, are you, James, by any chance?
No, okay. Don't worry.
I wouldn't worry. I just live in constant gratitude to all the doctors and nurses at West Middlesex Hospital. But on we go.
Yes. So essentially what happens is after there are multiple points that you can essentially increase the number of doctors. So you increase the number of doctors at medical school. You can increase the number of doctors in training positions. You can increase the number of doctors in higher training positions. And then you can increase the number of consultant jobs. What's essentially happened is over the last few years, the government has essentially increased the number of jobs, the number of medical students. So they're building more universities, which likely the UK probably needs. But what they haven't done is they haven't increased any of the jobs that are happening at the higher level. So you now currently have lots of UK graduates and also people from other countries as well, competing for the same amount of specialty training jobs as ever. And obviously the population is increasing, it's getting older. So it means that we actually need more doctors. But although there are people with medical degrees who can work the jobs, the actual employment roles at the hospitals or in the training programs are just not there.
So this is the bit I'm finding hard to grasp. Do you understand why I'm finding it hard to grasp, or am I sounding stupid to you, Doctor?
No, you're not sounding stupid at all. I think from speaking to my family,
yes.
I think it's quite hard to explain because it sounds ridiculous, because all of us have experiences with healthcare where we probably think another doctor probably could have made our experience either happen more quickly or wait in A&E, etc. But what essentially happens is I have a lot of friends now because I'm at a natural career break almost.
Right.
I've done the first 2 years of my foundation training, and then now I have a year where I can work on my portfolio and then apply to specialty training. But I have friends who weren't lucky enough to get this full-time employment to work on the portfolio, so they're trying to essentially make ends meet by doing locum work, essentially. And sometimes that locum work is by choice because people like the freedom of being able
to. Sometimes it's the only paid work they can get.
Exactly. And it's
when people say things like over a period of several years, my heart sinks a little bit because it makes it sound even harder to get to the nub of it. And is it simply the case that there is a finite amount of money to spend on the NHS, which is governed by how much they raise in tax, and the NHS needs more staff? Because demographics are changing and there are more people who need looking after. And of course, then bed blocking kicks in and all the other phenomena that we know quite a lot about now. And there is political resistance to the idea of spending significantly more money on the NHS, even though everybody in the NHS recognises the necessity of spending significantly more money. The problem there becomes, in the minds of the public, James, there's a very big difference between going on strike to create more roles for doctors and going on strike to create more pay for the doctors who've already got roles. And they're both in play during this industrial action. The big grievance is pay, not training roles. And I know that's a grievance and it's part of the deal, and I accept Jack Fletcher's explanation that Wes Streeting was being a little bit economical with the actuality in his so-called offer. But this strike is not exclusively about getting more doctors. It's about getting more money for the people who are already doctors, and that is where you lose the public.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think part of the problem is there's been a sort of muddying of the waters, because if you're in the doctoring community, people have been speaking about this for, like, even when I was at medical school, this has kind of been brewing,
right?
The full pay restoration element. But also the jobs element is a sort of newer issue that's come on. And because we were striking at the same time, they kind of got lumped together.
Yes.
I mean, my personal view is, with the jobs element, to address that first, in my view, the government train me as a doctor. I pay tuition fees, obviously. I have a student loan. But they subsidize universities because it's quite expensive to train a doctor.
Hmm.
But then they don't create any jobs later on. So it's almost as if their investment in me cannot be recuperated as effectively as possible.
Yeah.
So it almost becomes a bit of a strange situation where I'm here and they've trained me effectively. But I have a lot of friends who the situation I'll be in once my contract ends in August, let's say as I've currently applied to specialty training.
Yes.
If I don't get into specialty training, which I've done everything I can, but there's a possibility just because of the high numbers.
Yes.
I'll then apply to these locally employed doctor roles, right, that Jack Fletcher was referring to,
yes.
that they're going to make more specialty training jobs. If, let's say, if they made those into more specialty training jobs, then there would be fewer of those locally employed doctor roles, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
So then I'm
This is what he
now.
Means by rearranging the deck chairs.
Exactly. So then I'm there now in, let's say, May time, thinking about what job am I going to have in August. So genuinely, the thing that I would have to do in my position is I would have to apply to Australia, not even because I necessarily want to go, but because it is objectively, and ask any doctor, easier to get a job in Australia than it is in the UK.
So if you don't get the training role, then what are your options long term? I sense you wouldn't want to be a locum at all, let alone forever. Do you then consider becoming a GP, or forgive my ignorance? But
that's absolutely fine.
If you don't get into that, if you don't get onto that track towards the medicine you want to practice for the rest of your career, what are your options?
So specialty training includes GP as well.
That's okay.
So when I say applying to specialty training, I am also one of the options is I can apply to be a GP.
So if you don't, but then there's 10,000 people, there's 10,000 places with 40,000 applicants for these roles at the moment, for these
exactly,
specialty roles.
Exactly, including GP roles.
So what happens in the long term to the 30,000 who don't get one?
Well, that's essentially where we are now.
I think the
issue is that for us in the long term, basically what happens is we reapply next year.
Yes.
So we try to get a job to make ends meet, either these locally employed doctor jobs.
Right.
Or we locum, or we, if we're privileged enough, can travel or whatever, which is obviously a vast
minority. That's when you think about leaving the country.
Exactly. So
you'd still be a doctor, but you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be looking after the people whose taxes have funded your training.
Exactly. So, and I have lots of friends in Australia, and I personally don't even want to go there. Personally, if my family is here, and I just more prefer being in the UK. But I genuinely, if I don't get into specialty training, I'll have to make the decision of, is it easier for me to get a job in Australia, which all my experience has essentially said yes.
Yes, well, it would be, wouldn't it? Do we know why, James, finally? Do we know why Australia has got a health service that is so much more efficient and attractive than our own?
Yeah, so I think I wouldn't know the nuances of it,
sure.
the ins and outs, but I believe essentially the Australians are almost purposefully attracting UK doctors for whatever reason, because our...
But then that means that their training places for Australian-trained doctors will be reduced, or does it?
Exactly, it becomes this... almost ridiculous situation where we
take it in turns to be more attractive to doctors, and then we'll overtake Australia. I genuinely don't know. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. So then I essentially would go to Australia, and the thing that happens, just as to round it off, is when I'm in Australia, I am not able to compete for Australian specialty training jobs unless I'm there for a few years. However, people who come to the UK, and I have no problem with people who come to the UK. I'm an immigrant myself.
Sure.
When they come to the UK, they can compete on the same level as us. So regardless of where you graduated, you're seen as the same. Whereas if I went to Australia, I would have to work there for a number of years I'm competing at the same level.
So we're talking really about a clear path to positions and job security. That's what you're really after. I mean, and you say muddied the water. Thank you, James. Things are a lot clearer. I bet you've got a wonderful bedside manner. But you can't separate it, unfortunately, from the pay demands, which have upset a lot of people. It's a weird one, isn't it? I wonder how the BMA feel about that. I know they were on with Tom yesterday, but whether or not the majority of the people, how you would break down the arithmetic of that mandate, the 80-odd% who have voted to continue the strike, how much of that is about the pay rise and how much of that is about the other stuff? And if it was about everything that they're striking for, what would the ratio look like? I'm 52% on strike for more money for me, but I'm 48% on strike for more training places for people who aren't me. Or, of course, in the case of some resident doctors, people who aren't me. Thank you. It's getting a little bit clearer, I think, and it's becoming harder to oppose, isn't it? Unless you're inhaling your position from right-wing media, I would normally say, but of course that would now include the Labour government and Wes Streeting. So it's not fair to pin all this opposition on right-wing media when the actual Labour Health Secretary is on the other side of the fence from people like James. And I think people like me.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Once again, violent, murderous Islamism has raised its head. Imagine arming your son with a rifle, sending him out to kill indiscriminately men, women and children. What kind of worldview do you need to have as a father to even consider that as an outcome for your own flesh and blood? These people are not like us.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last. Subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
What makes the best roast dinner is deeply personal. And we've all got strong opinions on whether it's best with beef or chicken, roasties or mash, and if cauliflower cheese really belongs. It doesn't, by the way. But one thing isn't up for debate. A roast is always better with deliciously crispy, fluffy Paxo stuffing. Mmm. A roast isn't a roast without Paxo, the original stuffing, lovingly crafted since 1901.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to
stay out all night? Yahoo!
That's brilliant. So, okay, sales targets. Are we hitting
the dance floor?
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2-for-1, you can choose glasses for at least two use. From £70 with standard single-vision lenses.
Nice moves, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
Protect your pets over this festive period. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk and enjoy Christmas covered.
Music, news, celebrities, socials, entertainment, podcasts, video.
The world of media and entertainment is a world we all turn to every second that we can. And university isn't for everyone. So, if you're leaving school, take a look at joining Global Academy in year 14 to take a unique course in creative enterprise and kickstart your media career. Get industry experience, develop your entrepreneurial skills, and it's free. Apply now at globalacademy.com.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, drop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. T, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with
T-R-I-P. Think, do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 10:52. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. It's a funny one, isn't it? You kind of say to me, hand on heart, doctors got a 29% pay rise, 18 months or so ago, and they're going on strike again. And I go, come on, lads. Come on, ladies. Come on, lads, lasses. Give your heads a wobble. Fingers to the, shoulders to the wheel, fingers to the grindstone. You can't have it yet. You can't have it now. And then you understand the mess that the profession is in, the mess that the NHS is in, and the simple arithmetic of there not being enough roles, not being enough doctors in hospitals to improve morale and, crucially, patient care. And you think, well, maybe the only option you've got is to go on strike. I wonder how differently it would feel today. I'm not a massive fan of counterfactuals, but sometimes they do a job. They reach parts. How differently would it feel today if they were on strike exclusively over training contracts, training positions, security, and no mention whatsoever about pay rises? Would it be close to a 100% mandate of support for the strike among resident doctors and considerably higher among the public? I suspect it probably would, but they have elected not to do that. It's a conscious decision. So I have a few texts, if I may. The trouble with all these issues is that over the years we've had a boy crying wolf effect. Every time successive governments cut or trim budgets, the affected unions will come out against such cuts with warnings of issues that will occur following the cuts. For a long time, these effects have been kept artificially at bay due to the hard work of the public servants. Now, however, the dam is bursting and the wolves really are at the door. I buy that, Alan, and that's where that long list of things that occurred to me literally after coming on air of other public sector professionals who've warned what was happening to their profession and we didn't pay attention or we believed the people claiming that they were just crying wolf. Literally, I think, in Theresa May's case. Have I imagined that? Did she literally say that you're crying wolf to police officers who said if you cut our numbers, then the ability to attack crime, the ability to address crime will be reduced? I think she used that phrase. I could be wrong, and you will let me know, no doubt, if I am. But we didn't listen then. Should we listen now? That is from Alan. And this is from Steve, which I presume means that I misspoke earlier. Steve says it's Friends of Russia, James, not Friends of Israel. So I presume when I was talking about the Tories all queuing up in the Russian ambassador's garden, I may have accidentally said Friends of Israel instead of Friends of Russia. Although given that they were in the Russian ambassador's garden, it was probably easy to work out what I meant. Wendy is in Norwich. Wendy, what made you pick up the phone?
Hello, James.
Hello,
thanks for taking the call. I'm a retiring GP about to stop. So when I was last a resident doctor, it was about 35 years ago.
Okay.
But I have got two members of family who, one is a final year medical student at the moment, and the other one is an F3 doctor. So she's third year into her foundation year. She's applying for her specialty training in January. She's incredibly pessimistic. Oh. We used to say to my son, who's going to be 30 when he qualifies, he did another degree first.
Yeah.
We used to say, oh, you've got in, fantastic, you'll always have a job. But now, they're just such hollow words.
When did that change? When and why did that change? Because that is absolutely the heart of it for me, what you've just said.
It's exactly the heart of it. And I feel that the BMA, maybe they didn't say quite enough at the beginning, but for a very long time, they have been emphasising the job situation.
Yeah.
They've got the placard saying, patients need doctors, doctors need jobs. And unfortunately, the media, including the BBC, I used to watch BBC News and then turn over to Channel 4 News.
Yep.
Channel 4 News actually went into this quite many months ago.
Yes.
But the BBC was always about pay, and all the media has just been about pay. So it's the jobs. Anyone can do anything if they know it's finite. But at the same time, there was an interview with a surgeon the other day, mid-30s. He's one down from being a consultant. And they asked him how much he got paid, and he said 60,000. And I feel that a surgeon at a senior registrar level, life and death, nights, I know a lot of people think 60,000 is a good wage, but for that job,
I don't argue with that. I'm conscious of people who can't dream of earning that kind of money, having sort of goggle-eyed at the very thought of it and outraged at anybody saying it's not enough. But that's life, isn't it? That's always going to be true, whoever's getting paid what. But I want to push you back, if I may, to the point where it changed. The point where that idea of, right, I'm in now. Journalism used to be like that, believe it or not. I just probably missed that particular boat. But for my father's generation, if you got onto a national newspaper, you were probably there until your pension. So when did it change? Because it's much more recent for resident. When did it change, and how or why did it change?
It seems since he started at medical school. So he started in the final year now, 5 years ago.
Right.
Everything seemed, but you know, just like when you're training, you don't sort of get your head around it until you get closer towards it.
No, you've got exams to worry about. And can we think of a policy shift? Because I know that patient satisfaction, I'm obsessed with this statistic, in 2010 when David Cameron became Prime Minister, was the highest on record. And then austerity came in. So obviously taps were turned off or taps were turned down. But is there a specific pivot point that explains how that profession went from being one that offered lifetime job security to one that didn't? Or was it just incremental? Was it a frog boiling exercise?
It was several things during the last government over the years that they were in power.
So if the BMA had been campaigning on an undo the damage that the last lot did platform, again, they'd probably be engendering more public sympathy than they are as a consequence partly of media framing of the pay rise as being the beginning, the middle and the end of this grievance.
Exactly. And it's the other thing you mentioned earlier on, I know you've probably been explained about this since that, but it's not unfilled posts. I wanted to really emphasise that. There's even when my son during COVID, while he was about to do his medical training, was an HCA at the local hospital, they just said there's not a full-time post available.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I was trying to push James on that, because there are not unfilled posts, but there are not enough posts, is the
point.
And
the pay rise hasn't been funded. I think a lot of people don't realise that the pay rise was done. but it wasn't funded. So it came from somewhere else, so even fewer doctors, if you see what I mean. And the other thing to mention is that it doesn't just apply to doctors. This nurses and midwives are coming out of training.
Yes.
And can't get jobs either.
That was one mistake I made, although that one is defensible. The other one I made was thinking that a GP was separate from a specialty, and so I've cleared that up as well. And, you know, I do this stuff for a living, and if I can display fairly epic ignorance in a couple of areas, maybe I should be a little more forgiving of people displaying ignorance in other areas. I mean, family connections aside, although that's obviously very hard to do, they genuinely feel they have no choice. That's why the numbers are so high.
No choice
but to strike, because this is a perilous situation that we are in, and unless something serious is done to get us out of it, then the NHS itself is threatened.
Exactly. They all support the NHS, the ones I know. They all want to be in the NHS. It's a wonderful organisation, but it just needs to... Something needs to be sorted out to actually make more doctors and nurses and midwives on the front line, and dare I say, fewer managers.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, I always, people reach for that position, and I need to, again, a bit of a crash course on knowing how fair that is, but I think internationally we don't have a proportionately very high number of managers compared to doctors and nurses, but this is the whole point that's missing. We need a lot more doctors, nurses and midwives. And exactly. one of the ways in which you get more is by creating easier paths to those positions, and by paying more as well, perhaps. And that way, you don't have to go after people trained abroad who are perhaps less or happier to take lower wages. You want to have a gold standard of medics. So that's why Stephen is not an idiot necessarily, but everybody arguing about how if there's loads of doctors and a shortage of jobs, why do we need to pay them more? Because the doctors want there to be more doctors. That's the heart of it all. The doctors on strike think we need more doctors. And if you're not going to believe them, who are you going to believe? If you're not going to trust them, who are you going to trust? Unfortunately, because of the nature of this industrial action, it can be framed as demands for more money. But two things can be true at the same time. They want more money, but they really want more doctors too. And that's why I think I support them.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, counter-terror police are looking into reports the Bondi Beach gunman received training in the Philippines. 15 people were killed when father and son, Sajid and Navid Akram, targeted a Hanukkah event on Sunday. Lizzie Pearl is a journalist with Sydney's Nine News.
In that vehicle that they drove to Bondi Beach in on Sunday afternoon, there were two IS flags and a lot of homemade IEDs as well. So the terror links are being investigated right now by Australian Counter-Terrorism Police. It's also being investigated a trip that this father and son made to the Philippines in recent weeks. So why they went there, who they met with, what the purpose of that visit is now a very big focus.
Latest figures show the UK's unemployment rate rose to 5.1% in the 3 months to October. It's up from 5% in the previous quarter and the highest level since January 2021. There was also a fall in the number of staff on company payrolls. The Conservative Shadow Chancellor, Sir Mel Strides, told LBC he is not surprised.
If you tax something, you tend to get less of it. And the first thing that the government did when they came into office was whack taxes on businesses and particular jobs in terms of national insurance increases. They talked down the economy. They've mishandled the run-up to this budget by flying all these various kites on different taxes. Taxes that would go up, kill the animal spirits.
Resident doctors have rejected suggestions people will die as a result of their strike in England. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, told LBC last week patients could come to fatal harm during the five-day action. Medics are due to begin the walkout tomorrow morning. Dr. Shivam Sharma from the BMA has told LBC that deaths could actually go down during the action.
I want to be evidence-based. We know that senior colleagues, consultants will be covering this strike action. And we know that studies have shown that mortality rates do not increase, they stay the same, if not decrease, during strike action because we have those experienced senior consultants.
The BBC says it will defend itself against a $10 billion lawsuit from Donald Trump. The president's lawyers say the broadcaster maliciously sought to mislead viewers by editing his January the 6th speech. Licence fee reforms will be considered as part of the BBC's charter renewal process. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, has opened the once-in-a-decade review. A minute silence for the Bondi Beach attack victims will be held ahead of the third Ashes test tonight. There will also be increased security in Adelaide. England are 2-0 down in the series, with Australia needing only a draw to retain the urn. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was down 28 points at 97-23. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 13. LBC weather, a dry day with plenty of sunshine for most places, cloudier with some patchy rain in southeast England, a high of 12 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Is the time. I am not a lawyer, but I do know that most of Donald Trump's attempts to cow or extort money from broadcast organizations have succeeded in the United States only because the broadcast organizations that he was taking action against were also embarked upon potential business deals over which he or his allies had some sway. I don't think that's going to apply to the BBC, although he has, of course, or the United States has announced a pause to the deal that was signed when he came to England and was given that incredible stroke ludicrous reception with golden carriages and the poor king wheeled out to greet him and all sorts of pomp and ceremony, more pomp and ceremony than anybody could shake a scepter at. And I said to you at the time, the calculation here by Starmer, the gamble here by Starmer is that you can trust him. And you can't. And lo and behold, the big result, the big win of that visit has now been reneged upon, hopefully temporarily, but who knows, because the deals that Donald Trump negotiates are not worth the paper that they're printed on. No matter how much pomp and ceremony you treat him to, he will. It's a bit like the, what was it again, the frog and the what? I can't even remember. The frog and the scorpion? The frog and the scorpion, isn't it? So in this and that, well, this works. So Keir Starmer is the frog. And Donald Trump is the scorpion. Doesn't quite work because the United States will just try and get more and more and more out of the frog. But you say, I'll give you a lift over the river to the scorpion. And the frog says, please don't, you won't bite me, will you? Because if you bite me, we both drown. And the scorpion goes, don't be ridiculous. If I bite you, we both drown. So he hops on the frog's back. They start swimming across the river. Halfway across, the scorpion bites the frog. And they both drown. And as they're drowning, the frog says, why did you do that? And the scorpion goes, well, look, I'm a scorpion. That's what trusting Donald Trump is like. Oh no, he'll be different with us. He'll keep to our deal. He'll abide by the sort of network of obligation. I love that phrase. Do you know where that phrase comes from? Don't Google it. The network of obligation that binds us all. It's a beautiful phrase. Where did I first stumble across the phrase, the network of obligation that binds us all? 20th century. It's not one of the ancients. Late 20th century, it's not Winston Churchill. The network of, I'll give you a clue. I first came across it in the case of a man almost as awful as Donald Trump being described by one of his former teachers. He was described as someone who didn't seem to believe that he should have to follow the, quotes, network of obligation that binds us all. And when Trump does this stuff, of course, he destroys, he denigrates the network of obligation that binds us all, that keeps everything sweet or honest or above board. I may share that with you a little later in the programme. But the legal action that Donald Trump has brought against the BBC that you just heard about in Thomas's news bulletin contains, the scorpion stings, it doesn't bite, forgive me, nobody's perfect, contains a line of such beautiful simplicity that I felt compelled to share it with you. Imagine suing somebody for $5 billion and containing this line, writing this line in your lawsuit. Are you ready for this? Literally, I'm not making this up. No less an authority than the United Kingdom's former Prime Minister Liz Truss discussed this bias, the need to hold the BBC accountable, and the BBC's pattern of actual malice. Now, speaking of actual malice, we'll have a look in the next hour at what Donald Trump had to say after the passing, the murder of Rob Reiner, the film director, and his wife. But the BBC's pattern of actual malice. And we need someone who's really hefty. We need someone to back us, who's got real heft, who's taken very seriously by the world. Oh, well, we've got Liz Truss, Mr. President. That's great. Stick it in the lawsuit. Imagine describing Liz Truss as no less an authority than the United Kingdom's... I mean, it's sarcasm in anybody else's mouth. In any other context, if you wrote no less an authority than the United Kingdom's former Prime Minister Liz Truss, Private Eye might write that line, and it would be a Mickey take. The brilliant Henry Morris, whose work I just absolutely love, who's one of the a very modern satirist who does most of his work on Substack and social media, Henry Morris could write that line in one of his regular spoofs. No less an authority than the United Kingdom's former Prime Minister Liz Truss. But Donald Trump's lawyers apparently wrote that with a straight face. We've finally got the hang of this. I don't mean radio presenting. Let's not get carried away. I mean this particular subject. We finally got the hang of the neats. I don't know if you remember. I don't know how much you share in my qualms when I feel that we're not getting to the heart of a subject. We're not getting to the heart of a topic in the way that I want to do. But we have in recent weeks finally got to the heart of it. I think in our defence about not getting it right immediately, we were certainly right to suggest that it was poised to become one of the biggest stories facing the population, weren't we? First started talking to you, partly as a consequence of speaking to doctors and nurses, actually, partly as a consequence of having one child in the relevant age range, although she is very much in education and employment, actually. But the middle class vista that I see from my own personal perspective includes young people who are not in education, employment or training. And these are young people who have had many advantages in life. But, of course, all the advantages in life can't insulate you from health problems, mental health problems or physical health problems contingent upon long COVID or the viral load that still goes largely unrecognized by most of the commentariat. But there's no way that accounts for 946,000 young people aged from 16 to 24. And the reason why we didn't get this quite right when we first started talking about it was because we presumed that there would be a Rosetta Stone, that there would be a skeleton key to unlock the conundrum, to unlock the mystery, and there isn't. This is why I worry a little bit about the kind of rhetoric that we hear today from Alan Milburn, the former health secretary who's been charged with addressing this crisis. And I think you can call it a crisis. Personally, I wouldn't call it a benefits crisis. I'd call it a human crisis. I'd call it a crisis for young people. I wouldn't call it an outrage. I'd call it a tragedy. But that's because of the way that I'm made. If you want to call it an outrage, you can. But it creates the idea that all of these people are choosing to be inactive because the alternative is somehow more attractive. And while that will apply to some people, there's no earthly way it applies to 946,000 people. In fact, there's not a single thing that would be true of every one of those 946,000 people, apart from their species. They will have a species in common, and nothing else. Nothing else would apply to every single one of them, apart from their age range, they all fit in this category, and their species. They are all human beings. There won't quite be 946,000 answers to the question, why are you not in education, employment, or training, but there will be a hell of a lot more than one, or two, or three, or 10, or even 20. But what we want and what we look for together when we turn our attention to this crisis, this tragedy, as we do on a very regular basis, what we want is the biggest answers of all. And I want to go after two today, two very specific answers, or rather I want answers to two very specific questions, okay? And in a way they're linked, I think. In a way one goes hand in hand with the other. So the first is, how hard is it, right? This is really important. What I want to do is offer a corrective while fully recognizing that there is no one answer to 946,000 problems, But I want to offer a corrective to this ludicrous idea that is halfway around the world before the truth has got its trousers on, that this is a crisis of indolence or a crisis of lethargy or a crisis of laziness. If people are somehow electing not to enter employment or training, then it is in large part because what is on offer is so unattractive. And you could use that, of course, to call for a society in which people will starve unless they take whatever crumbs are falling from big business's table or whatever the crumbs the government have ring-fenced for them. But I think we're both wealthier than that and morally better than that. So, how hard is it? You can tell me yourself, 0345 60 60 973. You are age 16 to 24 and you don't want to be in this category, but it's incredibly difficult to get out of it. Or you can tell me about the young person in your life. And that in many ways is perhaps more helpful. Well, not more helpful, it's as helpful. It's at least as helpful because you can watch what's happening. And the crucial point here, okay, are you ready? The crucial point here is things are really different from when we were that age. If we could somehow program people, if we could reprogram the population to recognize that things are somehow, things are profoundly different from what they were like when we were that age. Because the answer to why is an 18-year-old not doing something can never be, I don't know, because it's really easy. When I was 18, it was easy. It just, well, maybe it can sometimes be true, but it's hardly ever the case that you can answer a question about why 18-year-olds today are in trouble by explaining that 18-year-olds when you were 18 were not. I don't know why it took me so long to work this out. It was in the context of university education, actually, not in the context of employment. But I suddenly realized that I was lecturing young people today based entirely on presumptions and understandings built 30 years ago when I was at university. And that was absolutely pointless, worthless, and ultimately insulting. But everybody still does it. Most obviously, they do it with property prices. A pal of mine has just calculated what his house would be worth if it had gone up at the same rate as his parents' house. I'll find it for you, actually. Stuck it on Blue Sky. Very, very, very funny man. He's also the one, if you follow me on that social media platform, he's the one that took his cat to the vets this morning. But he's just done a sum. He's literally calculated this morning what his house would be worth now if property values had gone up on the same gradient that they did from the moment when his parents bought their house many years previously. So to have a conversation about young people getting onto the property ladder based upon presumptions that are 40 years out of date is as pointless as having a conversation about young people not in education, employment or training based upon presumptions that are 40 years out of date. So question one, how hard is it actually? And you can tell me that it's easy, because that will account for some of the 946,000, but it won't account for all of them. How hard is it, compared to when you were their age, how hard is it to get a job? 0345 60 60 973 is the number that you need. Question number two. What's the point? Now, this addresses a very different plight. This addresses people who I actually didn't have much sympathy for when we started having these conversations. But I have sympathy for them now. And I'm thinking of young people who could do something. They could go into education, employment or training. But they don't see the point. Because they don't see it leading anywhere. This is arguably the most important question we can ask about these young people, right? When I was their age, certainly by the time I was 24, I was very, very much in the house buying lane. 4 years later, I bought my first flat. Didn't even need a deposit for it. I was also earning, you know, a good whack. Well, not at 24, actually, but by 25, 26, I was earning a good whack. And I could see ahead of me property ownership. I could see ahead of me a degree of job security. The world was always going to need, I thought, somewhat naively, journalists. I could see ahead of me a very realistic, I'm 53 years old if you're new to the program, I could see ahead of me a very realistic project prospect of being economically a bit, or even perhaps with luck, a lot more comfortable than my family, than my parents, who were well off. They sent me to public school. In terms of what's the point, I never needed to ask myself that question. It was clear to my generation what the point was. The things that we were aiming for, the social capital, as well, of course, as the actual capital. It was clear what the point was. So what I want you to imagine now is that you are addressing a 20-year-old who has perhaps applied for a few jobs, and that's where question one comes in. How hard is it to get anything or to get something? 03456060973. And you're addressing a 20-year-old who, for various reasons, has kind of given up. It's not because the welfare state is too generous. It's more likely because they have segued relatively effortlessly from living at home and being looked after by mum and dad, or mum or dad, and getting up every day to go to school or college and then coming home to be looked after by mum or dad. And they've segued fairly effortlessly to living exactly the same life, just without the bit in the middle where they get up to go to school or college. They haven't moved from that position. There's another story in the news today about precisely that. Families who expected to be empty nesters by now, but whose children are probably there forever. Again, something completely ignored by much analysis of this subject. My children, right, I love my children. And if, for whatever reason, whether it was ill health or simply a collapse in confidence, I would never chuck them out. I would always look after them. As long as I've got money in my pocket, my children are going to be okay. There must be parents listening to this now whose heart breaks at the absence of prospects for their children. But where 10 years ago you'd got angry with them, now you look at them and you think, I can't really blame you for having sort of given up. So what when they say to you, what's the point? What do you say to them? This is a question for the age. It's a question for everybody. So if the thing that is on offer to you is not going to deliver to the 20-year-old today, is not going to deliver any of the things that were on offer for the 20-year-old in your day, and they say, what's the point? What do you say to them? This is one of the most important questions I've ever asked you. And the tragedy here is that I don't know the answer. I've got a fat middle-class privilege pie in my fridge. I think my kids will be okay. I don't know for sure. But you get to that point, you get to that Rubicon in life when you leave college or school and then you decide what you're going to do next. And the answer is nothing. You've tried, perhaps, and it hasn't worked. That's question one. But question two is, what's the point? How do you answer that question? You don't even need children to answer this question. You just need to speak to my mythical, because you don't get self-respect. That would be one of the answers I'd have given once. You don't get self-respect if you're working for a pittance in a job that has no prospects. Where's the self-respect there? And also, you can see on your screen a universe that makes a mockery of whatever it is that is open. Do you see what I mean? What is the point? Is the question I really want you to answer. Phone lines are completely open now, so don't hold back thinking that everybody else will be in front of the queue for you. It's one of the strangest questions I've ever asked you, but it's also, I think, one of the most important and potentially one of the most interesting. What's the point? Here's a 20-year-old, not in education, employment or training. What few options are open to them are, compared to what was open to us when we were their age, spectacularly unattractive, and they turn to you and say, well, why should I? What's the point? What do you say to them? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. 03456060973.
This is LBC.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person, or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK. Retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics.
with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Tonight's EuroMillions jackpot is £14 million.
I think that deserves a whoop whoop. Thank you, faraway person. Get in tonight's EuroMillions draw. Play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low, slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curve leg, flared, straight or skinny.
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. These changes will affect how you manage your tenancies. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60973.
It's 24 minutes after 11. This is good from No Hostages, another one of my favourite social media accounts over on Blue Sky. When one young person is out of work or training, you can maybe blame the individual. When it's 1,000, possibly even 10,000, you can keep telling that story. When it's 946,000, the problem isn't them, it's the system. I have an enormous amount of sympathy for that position. And it's where parts of today's questions come from. Question one, how hard is it to be a neat, or more pertinently, to stop being a neat? And then question number two, what do you say to a young person caught in this sort of Scylla and Charybdis who doesn't see the point? What's the point? I'll get some text up on this one as well, because it could lend itself to quite pithy answers. Let me just clear the box of the last hour's questions. Let's go to Guildford. Olivia is there. Olivia, what would you like to say?
Hiya, James. I just wanted to mention I am a care leaver, so I'm in more of an unusual position than some.
Yes.
But I think people in my generation have realised that this isn't the way we're supposed to live. Since COVID, we saw people were housed. We saw that there weren't people on the streets. We saw that people could be supported.
Yes.
And I think there's no way for the government to pull the wool over our eyes anymore and tell us that it can't, that isn't doable.
But how does that impact on your day-to-day existence, though? Because that's a sort of theoretical or philosophical overview, isn't it?
Because I think it contributes to the mental health and the depression and the lack of motivation in people my age, because they don't see the point of functioning in a society that they feel is detrimental to their mental health and isn't actually going to benefit them.
And what are your options?
I
don't want to badger you, but and also you can't speak for an entire generation, but let's say, and also as I've stressed repeatedly, there's no way there's going to be one answer that applies to 946,000 people, but the cohort that you are speaking of or speaking for who are disillusioned, if you like, with the system and therefore reluctant to become part of it, what are their options? What are the alternatives?
Well, that's the thing. I think people are getting themselves in a spiral, in a hole, and I totally see why, to be honest. And then it feels so hard to get back out of that. And you're just thinking, why this? If I try and get into this and try and get into this job, that's what's going to affect me mentally. That's being treated well at work, not having people make people help so that you can come back into work if you have problems like autism, depression, making these exceptions to help people be able to come back to work. But because it's so competitive, people aren't going to say they're going to be flexible for this person because there's someone else there ready to do it and ready to work themselves to the bone. Because they know they have to, just because they've been raised to know that this is what you have to do to survive, and if you don't, that's it.
And less bleak, perhaps, but again, from a position of privilege, is that the things that were within reach made the grind worthwhile. Those things are no longer within reach.
I do feel when you leave school, if you go to college, I found at college a lot of people were just there again, like say to their parents, sending them there.
Yeah.
Once you leave, it's so important that you reach out for the opportunities that there are in school and college, because once you leave, it's like there's nothing. Suddenly you are just like, I wasn't at home, but for people who are, I understand, you're just at home. If you don't have to and your parents can afford to have you there and they love you and they want you to to be happy, why would they make you
go out and beat yourself up every day for minimum?
They'd probably rather support you until they die.
And you think that's a thing? That's a growing thing? Is it just this idea of people opting out entirely with support of a family who would once have been very impatient? Mums and dads, and I know you're a care leaver yourself, but you'll know what I'm talking about friends and peers.
Yeah, I didn't have the opportunity to not work, so I had to support myself, but that put me into a severe mental pit, and now I'm not able to work because I was forced. You have to do it or that's it. It was a survival. And then that pushed me even further down. So now it's even harder for me to get back to work because employers aren't able to make these exceptions to help out.
I don't really want the first caller to go here, but perhaps that was a bit naive of me. When I'm asking people to tell you what the point is, the really obvious answer is that there isn't one.
Yep, basically.
Do you dream?
You're not supposed to be living like this.
Do you dream, Olivia?
I do.
What do you dream of?
I dream, I know it might sound a bit hippy-dippy socialist, I do dream of just living on a commune with my family, really, and growing a place for people I love and care about.
So self-sufficiency, a form of self-sufficiency.
Yeah, because that's kind of what I see my generation or the people I socialise with. I see that that's a growing want and trend, and that is the dream, because I feel that that is the natural way that we should be living, really.
Okay. And, you know, some people will be chomping at the bit listening to you.
Thinking I'm ridiculous, hippie, yeah.
Some people will be nodding sagely, and there'll be plenty of people my age who had very similar dreams when they were your age, and whether or not those dreams were dashed or whether or not they managed to realise them and whether or not they are naive or unrealistic is one of those questions that can't be answered in the same way today that it could be answered when I was your age, when I was 20, because the world has changed immeasurably. What's the point? Can I use you? Can I invite other callers to tell you what the point is of getting on the hamster wheel, of getting into the rat race, or would that be unfair? I'm not going to keep you on the line. Don't worry. You can go about your daily business.
I just do want to thank you because I listen to you every morning, and so does my dad.
That's nice.
And I just, you make such a difference, honestly.
That's a lovely thing to say. Thank you. And it is partly because I can't answer the question on your behalf that I need you to call me on days like today. What is the point? 0345 60 60 973. It's 31 minutes after 11. Thomas Watts has your headlines.
Authorities in Australia are investigating a trip the Bondi Beach attackers made to the Philippines last month. New footage shows a couple in their 60s who were killed in the shooting, tackling one of the gunmen. A government minister says the BBC should stand firm in the face of a lawsuit from Donald Trump. The broadcaster says it will defend itself against the $10 billion action over the editing of a speech. Official figures show another weakening in the jobs market, with unemployment at 5.1% in the 3 months to October. Wage growth also fell back, which analysts say strengthens the case for a cut to interest rates later this week. LBC weather, dry with sunshine for most places, cloudier with some patchy rain in the southeast, a high of 12 degrees.
This is LBC.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the art and design industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Keo, an art and design student in year 12.
As an art student, we get the chance to work on our own pieces, either in the studio or using the digital software. Some of my work has also been shown in galleries, and last week I got the chance to attend a design agency to learn more about my future career.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
When you're smiling.
Don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
What makes the best roast dinner is deeply personal.
And we've all got strong opinions on whether it's best with beef or chicken, roasties or mash, and if cauliflower cheese really belongs. It doesn't, by the way. But one thing isn't up for debate. A roast is always better with deliciously crispy, fluffy Paxo stuffing. Mmm. A roast isn't a roast without Paxo, the original stuffing, lovingly crafted since 1901.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 11:34. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. The comedian I was speaking of earlier is Alistair Barry. If you ever get the chance to catch him live, I cannot recommend it highly enough. And he made me chuckle twice this morning. But the second time was after he revealed he's calculated how much their parents paid for their house. His parents paid for their house in 1978 and what it's worth now. And if, his house were to go up in a similar way, if the gradient was as steep, then in 2060 his house would be worth £14 million. Spoiler alert, it is worth nothing like that. But as he said himself, I'm really hoping I can hang on that long. And it's a wonderful illustration of how absolutely bonkers it is, forgive me, to ask people who are old their solutions to the problems faced by the young, if they're going to come up with things drawn from their experiences when they were young. And I include myself in that category. The other thing Alistair did this morning that made me laugh was take his cat to the vets. Why is that funny, I hear you say? Well, you don't know what his cat's called. So this is what he posted. I've just been laughed at by an entire vet's waiting room when the receptionist loudly welcomed me as an asteroid destroyer to the building. So it would be like, could Mr. Barry, no, it would be Mr. O'Brien and Tiddles please make their way into surgery two? And then, you know, we'd go through to there and there it would be, would Miss Walsh and Polly the poodle please make their way into surgery one? And then you go through, and then it would be, would Mr. Barry and Asteroid Destroyer please make their way to the nurse's office, please? And so the cat's in one of those ludicrous cat carriers that's got a sort of bulbous perspex dome on the front of it as well, so it actually looks like an astronaut cat. I think, did I share it? I did. If you follow me on Blue Sky, you can see it already this morning. And then, just to keep things topical and on point for listeners to the James O'Brien Experience, he came back on a little later and said, in even better news, a lady just sat down next to us with her cat, Keith. So there's another Keith, and almost certainly a younger Keith than our Keith, which we're on a perpetual quest to find the youngest Keith in the country. And speaking of people with names that we ordinarily associate with rather older people, I have deleted the message by accident from the lovely lady asking me to stop using Herbert as a pejorative because she has a six-year-old. Of human, by the way, of precisely that name. I will find that message. Can we find that message again? And I will do my level best. I promised a lovely lady called Doris not long ago that I would stop referencing your Auntie Doris's Facebook page when describing people of a certain age who'd fallen down conspiracy theory rabbit holes. And I tried. I've tried my best. But I don't know that I kept it up indefinitely, and the same with your Uncle Keith's Facebook page. But what other names can you use? So to Hannah in Wandsworth, I am sorry. I love you, James, she writes, which is the best way of getting a critical message read out on this program. But could you please stop using the name Herbert in a derogatory fashion, as it's the name I gave my now six-year-old son. It does make me smile, but as he gets older, I'd like him to listen to you, and I don't want him to be upset by it. Could there be a more powerful plea than a future listener being alienated by me turning his name into a byword for teasing? So if you catch me using that word again, all I would urge you to do is have a little look at what happened when the so-called Institute of Economic Affairs tried to get me into trouble. If you just, you can find that. It was reported in some newspapers, not all. But when the so-called Institute of Economic Affairs complained about me for years on end, God knows how much it cost them, and then got told to sling their hook at the end of the process, have a little look at that story, because that's where the word Herbert possibly enjoyed its finest hour. But if you ever catch me using it in a derogatory fashion, please point it out to me. And the more you point it out, the quicker I will excise it from my vocabulary of mild teasing insults. My apologies to you, Hannah. 11:38 is the time. A lot of love coming in for you, Olivia, if you are still listening. A lot of people indeed agreeing with your analysis of life. I'm 38, says James, and I completely agree with Olivia. I'd love to live somewhere where self-sufficiency was possible. And this, perhaps even more arresting from Carlene, she writes, honestly, James, there is no point. I'm lucky enough to have a job as a recent graduate. I graduated last year, but it doesn't pay enough. I can save maybe £100 a month if I'm lucky. Getting a job is hard enough, especially within your desired career. You'll have a heck of a journey to get there. My commute is about 1 hour 20 one way on a good day, costing me £300 a month, and I'm lucky at that price compared to some of my peers. So you've got no growth or benefits in the job. The mental effects are draining. The physical effects are immense. And the amount of people who are constantly sick as a consequence is off the chart. So, you know, the question to someone with a job, what's the point? And she answers it, the point is, why have a job that pays low and makes you sick when you can stay at home and at least not feel sick, even if you have a little change at the end of the day? Susie's in Harrow. Susie, what would you like to say?
Hi, I'm a mother of three boys, 16, 19 and 21.
Yes.
I would consider myself in middle class, and I'm really, really concerned about futures for my children and just the younger generation.
Yeah.
In terms of once they finish at 18, there aren't any jobs. So my 19-year-old finished an animal management BTEC. He's 19, couldn't find anything in this industry. Looked at all of the apprenticeships. You know, there are not a lot of apprenticeships around. Mm. All of the, they can't even get hospitality jobs very easily. And, of course, unemployment at 5.1%, you know, the rate's going up. There aren't any jobs. So that generation and all of his cohort also, if they're lucky, they've got a part-time job and pets at home or somewhere. Otherwise, they're just sitting around, I don't know, doing nothing. And that's when the mental health issue comes in.
Yeah.
So I've actually told him, you need to go to university. And he didn't want to go to university because of the, 40, 50 grand debt that you come out with. Because I think it's better that he gets a qualification and he's out of the job market for 3 years until things improve.
Yeah.
I've got my eldest son is 21 and he's a big brain. He's studying physics.
Right.
And he finishes this year and he is concerned about getting a job. So you can imagine.
Yeah.
And some of his friends have graduated this year already. And one was doing cybersecurity, got a cybersecurity degree at Warwick.
Okay.
He's been working as an Uber driver. Now,
I thought cybersecurity was quite a growth industry at the moment, but do I know?
Yeah. So he got a job as a, graduate schemes. I mean, those have reduced massively. But, you know, a top university like Warwick. And he was working as Uber driver. Now, luckily, he's managed to find something. But the rounds that they have to go through to get something. But I've got another one of his friends who's, I've been trying to help because I'm in HR.
Okay. Oh, Lord.
And to do his CV, he's a law graduate. And he struggled to get a job in M&S. He just got a job in M&S stacking shelves. So,
what do you say then? So when they say to you, I mean, let's take that job there. And stacking shelves is close to being a figure of speech, isn't it? For what have also been, I think Douglas Copeland referred to them as muck jobs back in the day in his book Generation X. And I don't want anybody who does that to feel that we're judging them or looking down on them, but it's not what he expected to do when he graduated with a degree in law. If he said to you, what's the point of stacking shelves when I could just stay at home all day and not have a very pleasant or luxurious existence, but I'd be safe, I'd be warm, and I'd be fed. What's the point of stacking shelves?
Well, I mean, luckily, I'm not getting those questions, but I'd be saying you absolutely
you are now, mate.
Need to work.
I'm asking you.
Well, I mean, I would say 100% you need to be out there working.
Why?
The worst thing you can do is sitting at home.
Why?
Because of your mental health.
No, that doesn't work like that, does it, though? You don't think? I mean, mental health doesn't work like that. It's not a self-policing or self-regulating. Mm. Why should I go and stack shelves for minimum wage when it's not going to lead me anywhere?
Well, you can't just sit. I would be saying you can't just sit at home because it is your mental health.
So would I be saying that? But it wouldn't wash. It wouldn't touch the sides of somebody saying, "What's the point?" You say, "Well, because if you save, you could put the deposit down on the flat, or because if you do that, then you might get on the graduate trainee scheme, or you might do this, or you might do that, or it might lead somewhere." I mean, where do these roads lead?
I mean, I don't have an answer to that. No? I mean, it's a difficult thing, but the government needs to create a lot more apprenticeships and force big employers to take on.
And yeah, big employers are telling us at the moment that they can't afford to wash their face. Employers are telling us that. And I wonder, I mean, obviously, given the country that we live in and the way our media operates, I'll try and pin this on Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, who, with their national insurance contributions, haven't made anything better and have almost certainly made some of these things worse. But you're talking about a decade and a half inheritance here. You're not talking about recent developments. And a lot of that ideology was that you should let employers do whatever they want and the rest of us would be okay. And that's really what Tufton Street exists to do, to defend the interests of employers or of capital or of wealth and expect the rest of us to fall into place. And this is a consequence of that. I wonder cyclically when it falls to employers to provide the point. This is kind of where Susie's led me. It kind of falls to employers who will need a workforce, even in the world of AI, to provide the point. I remember being repulsed. Someone sent me the comic strip from Viz by Barney Farmer and Lee Healy, which is just so powerful. Full page strip of a lad on a 0 hours contract. It was like something out of Hogarth. I'll find it for you and I'll post it on Blue Sky. It's like something out of Hogarth and robbing young people of hopes and aspirations. Not all of them, and, you know, obviously not all of them, but robbing them of that in order to increase dividends or in order to pay shareholders or to, you know, I always love the story about the bloke who takes his worker out into the car park and shows him his Porsche and says, listen, Keith, if you work hard for the next couple of years, then 2 years from now, I'll be able to afford another Porsche. I love that story. It's a little bit glib. It's a little bit Wolfie Smith, isn't it? But they've had something taken away from them, young people, and shouting at them isn't going to give it back. It's 11:45.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The Prime Minister's urged doctors to push back against the BMA, the British Medical Association, over a strike this week. He says it's, quote, self-indulgent, irresponsible and dangerous. Chris in Richmond.
The double standards are incredible. One minute they're saying, well, we need more money because we're important to society, and next minute they're telling you, well, if we go on strike, it's not going to kill patients. Which is it?
Stevens in Bristol.
As a doctor myself, I'm actually in support this time and this homelessness. The money, as important as it is, we all came into medicine knowing we weren't going to get rich. We came into medicine to support people during the difficult time, and we're not getting that opportunity.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, stop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Think, do the 4-trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
This could be the best Christmas ever. Christmas Cash Call is here with a life-changing £500,000 to be won. Enter this week's draw before 5 p.m. Friday and you could get a call with £500,000. Christmas Cash Call. Text radio to 822-00 to enter now. Text costs £2.50 plus your standard network charge. 18 plus UK only global network competition. Full rules and free entry at christmascashcall.com.
You are not an egg. You should not be put in a box. But when it comes to retirement advice, that's how some people get treated. Put in a one-size-fits-all box. Not at Fisher Investments UK. We work with you to create a personalised retirement plan. Fisher Investments UK. Retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
What makes the best roast dinner is deeply personal. And we've all got strong opinions on whether it's best with beef or chicken, roasties or mash, and if cauliflower cheese really belongs. It doesn't, by the way. But one thing isn't up for debate. A roast is always better with deliciously crispy, fluffy, Paxo stuffing. Mmm. The roast isn't a roast without Paxo, the original stuffing, lovingly crafted since 1901.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to...
Stay out all night! Yoo-hoo!
That's brilliant. So, OK, sales targets. Are we hitting...
The dance floor! Party time! Woo-hoo!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2-for-1, you can choose glasses for at least two yous. From £70 with standard single vision lenses.
Nice moves, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
James O'Brien on LBC.
It is 11:48 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Just an interesting one here. I kind of keep track of this stuff, but it's almost impossible. You've got one of Farage's candidates who is in hot water for telling David Lammy to go home, which presumably means to Tottenham, doesn't it? I mean, what would somebody mean if they were telling David Lammy to go home? I think he was born in Archway, but North London, essentially. But of course, it being one of Nigel Farage's politicians, he actually means the Caribbean. So someone running to be mayor of Hampshire and the Solent who suggested that that's where David Lammy's, quotes, loyalties lie. He should, quotes, go home to the Caribbean. Now, Nigel Farage is still hiding because he doesn't want to be asked questions about either his protege, close friend and party leader in Wales taking bribes from a Kremlin stooge in order to parrot Kremlin talking points in public spaces, all of which, as far as I can tell, have also been parroted by Nigel Farage, although there is no suggestion that he took any bribes whatsoever for saying very similar things about poking the Russian bear or about NATO being on the borders of Russia and similar. So he's still hiding, also because he doesn't want to answer questions about the toxic racism and anti-Semitism that he indulged in on an almost daily basis, as far as we can tell, at school. But this is a really interesting moment, because one of the things he stands accused of is telling a young black lad to go back to Africa. And we can find out whether he, because he hasn't apologised for anything yet, but we can find out whether or not he's changed, can't we? By seeing how he responds to a candidate in his own party who is telling a black politician to go home to the Caribbean. It's exactly the same language of his own school days. A few people queuing up, essentially, to claim that we shouldn't pay too much attention to what Farage was like when he was 18. And if you subscribe to that school of thought, you're perfectly entitled to find out what he's like when he's 68, or however old he is, 58. So there it is. Here's his opportunity to put some clear blue water between his childhood self and his candidate in Hampshire and the Solent, and him today. So there you have a reform politician telling a black British man to go home to the Caribbean, just as a reform leader, as a schoolboy, told a black fellow pupil to go back to Africa, reportedly. Wait and see. Don't hold your breath, though, eh? Back to NEETs and the question of what is the point? What do you say to someone in their 20s who honestly can't work out what the point is? Joel's in Barnes. Joel, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome, mate.
Yes, you can probably hear it in my voice. I'm a little bit nervous to call in. This is my first time ever doing this.
It's only me. Don't worry. You'll be fine. You're already doing brilliantly.
Yes. All right, so I have a few points. So I'm 22. I graduated about 15 months ago with a marketing degree. Okay. And it wasn't from one of the best unis in the country, but it was still a respectable uni. So I've been applying for jobs, and I was talking to your researcher.
Yes.
And if I'm to put a round number on it, I think I've applied for close to 500 jobs since graduating.
Wow.
And the split is about 100 part-time jobs, 300 office jobs, which are like what you would you'd have a 9-to-5, and then about another 100 to 150 graduate roles.
Okay.
And like, I've been in the position where I'm questioning myself. I'm thinking, what is the point? Like, I'm putting myself out there constantly, and I'm getting rejections. And the thing that even hurts more is when you're putting yourself out there and you're not getting the rejections, and you're thinking, oh, I still have hope. I still have hope. And like, how I've overcome that is, I've been thinking, like, what's the worst thing that could happen? I get a rejection, or they don't even get back to me. And then I'm thinking, what's the best thing? And it's feeling more fulfilled. It's feeling like the job I'm doing is actually making a difference and that I'm moving forward. And as of now, I've got like a 12-hour contract at a part-time job. And
12 hours a week?
I'm working, yeah, 12 hours a week, yeah. And I'm working close to 50 hours.
Right.
And in overtime. And yes, the money is great, and it's the same money that I would have got if I had got a graduate role out of uni.
Okay.
But the thing that really pushes me to keep applying for these jobs is the fact that 50 hours a week doing a job that there's no progression, you're not going anywhere. You're basically, I work with a lot of people that have been doing it for 15 years.
Yes.
And a lot of them are saying, look, this can't be it for you. You're still young.
Wow.
Keep applying for these jobs. And yeah, so that's what pushes me. Another thing, right?
How close have you got to a graduate level job? Out of those 100, 150?
So that's a great question.
Thank you. I've done this before, John.
Right. Right. So I'm currently, I've applied for a job as a marketing graduate for a mechanical engineering company just outside of London.
Hmm.
And what it is I've talked to the founders, I've had two interviews. And between my first and second interview, I've sent follow-up emails saying, hey, look, I really enjoyed the interview. Can I have some feedback? How did you like my interview? And they were like, oh, yes, we loved it. You are in the final two.
Wow.
We'll be in contact to set up a meeting. And I said, yeah, that's great. Please let me know as soon as possible.
Mm.
A week goes by. And then I get an email saying, oh, sorry, we forgot about you. We didn't see your email.
Oh, no.
Can you come in tomorrow?
Oh, okay. But you can't because you've got a job. You've got your job.
No, that's the thing. I have a job, yes, and I've already picked up the overtime for that day. And I was like, I called my manager. And I'm like, please, can I get the morning? And he was like, yes. Because the job that I'm at now, they're quite supportive for people to move on.
Yeah.
And so I go in for this interview. I've already prepared a PowerPoint of, like, examples of work. Because in the first one, I did the same thing. And then I talked to one of the founders. And he was like, this is the way we want to go. So I took that on.
Wow.
Made, like, a whole portfolio of things.
Yeah.
Like, LinkedIn posts, local sponsorships, like, charity events. Trade show media and stuff.
Yeah.
And I've gone in. I think I did great in the interview, and they were really happy, and they were like, look, we'll be with you within a week. We are going to make the decision by Friday.
Yeah.
It's Monday at that point. And that was a month ago.
And you haven't heard anything since?
I've sent three emails.
Oh, man.
No reply.
I'm sorry. That sucks.
But yes, but I'm still very motivated to keep going, because if I got that close... It's only going to take a little bit of luck to get that close again, and maybe then I'll get it.
Can I tell you something?
Yes.
You might not be feeling it at the moment, but you are exceptional.
Yes, thank you.
No, I mean it. I mean that word literally. You are exceptional, because I'd have given up if I'd been through what you're describing. And maybe not forever. But for a while, I'd have thought, right, sack it. I'm just going to do the 50-hour-a-week job, keep my head down, get some money, maybe go traveling. Yeah, but I wouldn't still be sticking my head above the parapet.
Yes.
I wouldn't still be hoping. I wouldn't still be following up. 500 applications, 500 knockbacks, a sniff of success like that, and then another slap in the face. You, Joel, are exceptional, and you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
That's the good news. The bad news is you're no use to me. Because I know you're going to be okay by talking to you. I worry about the 22-year-olds who have got 80% of your resolve, or 50% of your resolve, or 20% of your resolve, and they would have been okay too once. But they also would have been okay once. But that is the point that I'm making this hour, is that you kind of know what the point is, and you can keep hold of that, and you can keep sight of it, and you can endure more knockbacks than most of us could endure, and still have that point ahead of you, that point of light at the end of the tunnel that you're currently in. See, I have enormous sympathy for the people whose lights have gone out, especially if they've been through what you've already been through, and that's why you're going to be okay. But that's no consolation or use to you now in the context of this conversation. It's just encouragement, and you don't really need that.
I need it a lot more, yes. you get me through all my shifts when I'm working, yeah.
And why did that employer not come back to you? Why did that employer not come back to you? That's just rude, isn't it, man?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard running a business. It's quite a large business, and sure. They've got like a lot of revenue. And yeah, I do understand that.
But if I tell you what you've done, another thing you might not realise, listening to this, people who thought they knew the answers to the questions that I'm asking didn't realise we were talking about young people like you. Now, you're not a neet because you are in employment, albeit you're not on a career path that you would want to be on or expect to be on. But, I mean, Hart's just texted to say, if someone this articulate is going through what he is going through, what hope is there for everybody else?
There's always hope, I think.
Oh, there is always hope. You're a good man. There will be a few people who get in touch with me now suggesting that you get in touch with them. I'll leave that with Eleanor. And I don't know how much hope you should pin to that or anything like that, but I mean, it would be wonderful if somebody looked upon the conversation we've just had as an introductory interview for what you, as a marketing graduate who clearly knows what he's up to, might be able to do for their company. But again, I mean it. You're exceptional and you will be okay. But goodness me, you illustrate for the rest of us how hard it is for everybody, full stop, not just everybody else. It's coming, I got a final word from Roddy, bottle the guts and the enthusiasm of this lad, and I couldn't agree more. But 500 job applications have got him precisely nowhere. In the next hour, we turn our attention to Donald Trump, and a question I haven't asked you for a while, what's wrong? What's actually wrong?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, it's understood the surviving gunman in the Bondi Beach terror attack has woken from his coma. 24-year-old Navid Akram remains in hospital in Sydney under police guard. 15 people were killed in the targeted attack on Jewish people on Sunday. Bryna Liberoff, who lost her cousin, attended a Hanukkah event in Manchester last night.
Ellie was literally killed doing good, amazing work. I mean, he was just cut down and shot. It just causes sheer hatred. It's just very, I don't know if sad is the word. It's just, I can't even think of the word. It's...
Counter-terror police are looking into reports the Bondi Beach gunman received training in the Philippines. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, says talks with the US on a peace deal with Russia could be finalised within days. He's described a draft proposal as very workable, but warned some territorial issues remain unresolved. The defence secretary, John Healey, who has just announced £600 million for Kiev's air defences, says the war is at a major moment. Young people were among the hardest hit in another increase in unemployment in the 3 months to October. The main rate rose to 5.1%, its highest level in nearly 5 years. Christian May is editor-in-chief at City AM.
We know, of course, that this has been building up. This has been the case for month after month after month. And we know the impact on employment that taxes on employment have had, uncertainty around the budget, general tax increasing measures, and, of course, most recently we learned basically zero growth.
The Tories have blamed anti-business policies, but Labour says the figures reflect the scale of the challenge it inherited. The former Health Secretary, Alan Milburn's, warned there is a real risk of a lost generation in Britain. He is beginning an investigation into the causes of high levels of unemployment and inactivity among younger people. Mr. Milburn's expected to publish a report next year. The BBC says it will defend itself against a $10 billion lawsuit from Donald Trump. The president's lawyers say the broadcaster maliciously sought to mislead viewers by editing his January the 6th speech for Panorama. Separately, ministers have confirmed they will look at licence fee reforms as part of the BBC's charter review. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 97.23, down 28 points. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.13. LBC weather, dry today for many places with some sunshine, but cloudier with patchy rain in the southeast. A high of 12 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Any tips for the racing?
Yeah, your best bet is to enter BetVictor for their new customer welcome offer. If you bet a minimum of £10, they give you £20 in free bets on the horse racing. But here's another tip. If you're at the races, head to the paddock. You get lots of info they don't put in the race cards.
Like what?
Like the fact I'm seeing one of them drop a lot of weight right now.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet on the racing at BetVictor. 18 plus, opt in, bet on horse racing at odds of evens or greater, no cash out, 7-day expiry, terms and conditions apply, gambleaware.org.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Actually, I probably misspoke earlier. Nigel Farage has issued a statement about the candidate to be a mayor who told David Lammy to go back to the Caribbean because that's where his loyalties lie. I have the full statement here.
Bernard Manning.
There we go. 3 minutes after 12 is the time. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I want to turn your attention next to Donald Trump, if I may. When is the last time? Because we stopped doing it, didn't we? Trying to work out what motivates him, what explains him, and his supporters, the people who he understood so implicitly when he described them as people who would not abandon him even if he shot someone in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue. We used to, if you're new to the program or newish to the program, you probably don't know. I mean, we still talk about it quite a lot because he is obviously the most important figure on the world stage by dint of being President of the United States. But we used to be a lot more hopeful about our ability to unpick him or our ability to understand him. Because if you want to know what somebody's going to do next, your best bet is to understand why they did the last thing that they did. And I realized some time ago that that is a waste of time with Donald Trump. In fact, there was proof positive of it this morning. Not so much with the story about him suing the BBC while claiming that Liz Truss is the very paragon of witnesses for the support of his case, but more with the announcement that the tech deal that was, I think it was even signed. I certainly remember them standing in front of lecterns holding up documents. But the tech deal that was signed with the US as a sort of culmination of that ludicrous visit, that ludicrous state visit that saw every golden carriage in the country being pressed into service in order to drive Donald Trump and his wife around King Charles's garden. That culmination has now been paused. It was announced yesterday. Whether it's linked to the BBC story or not, I don't know. I suspect it is. He probably thinks Keir Starmer will be in a position to exert pressure on the BBC to pay. Keith's done a calculation. £209 each per licence fee payer. That's what it would cost to give Donald Trump $5 billion. And that is, of course, the only real income stream that the BBC has. So that would be 200. It's really us that he's suing. And remember, when I asked you earlier, is there anybody you can't be turned against? And I listed all the public sector people. But if you were to dip your toe into some of the sewers online now, lots and lots of British people have been turned against their own capital city, despite the fact that it routinely tops international polls as the best place to live, work, visit, and all the rest of it. But Billy Bunch of Numbers on Twitter is absolutely adamant, despite the fact that his account probably comes out of the Philippines or St. Petersburg. London is lost. London has fallen. So you can be turned against your own capital city. What else could you be turned against by these people? Things that you would never imagine you could possibly be turned against with lies. Firefighters, teachers, police officers, junior doctors, resident doctors, forgive me, nurses, and now your own capital city. The list goes on. But the idea, and of course the BBC, that's why I'm wanging on about this stuff. You can be turned against the BBC, the state broadcaster. Incredible value. Imperfect institution. I've got enormous problems with some of their so-called journalism, but they can turn you against that as well. And in the words of Joni Mitchell, you won't know what you've got till it's gone. So Trump probably thinks that the Prime Minister will be able to exert pressure on the BBC to settle with him over this ludicrous lawsuit. But I don't know that that's the case. I don't know that the Prime Minister would have any ability to do that, despite politicians today calling upon him to stand firm. It was called the Technology Prosperity Deal, wasn't it? It was billed as historic when it was unveiled during that state visit, and it has now been paused, reportedly because the United States want more concessions and more capitulations from the United Kingdom. Said it at the time. And I'll say it again, no deal that Donald Trump signs or agrees to or whatever else, what other words you want, is worth the paper that it's printed on or the breath that is expended in explaining it. So that's the news from the Trumpiverse. except it's not. We gave up trying to work out what motivated him some time ago because the task was beyond us. It proved impossible. We heard words like sociopath quite a lot, narcissist quite a lot, malignant quite a lot. I'm slightly wary of getting too personal. I know that sounds naive, but, you know, there's not much point being disgusted by someone's conduct if you don't try to be better. But he did something yesterday morning that I honestly thought must be a hoax. I honestly thought that this must be a spoof, a parody, or mischief, disinformation, fake news, to coin a phrase. And I'm going to read it to you in its entirety, because I think it's the single most disgusting thing I can remember a senior politician doing in power. And senior politicians in opposition can be slightly different figures, can be slightly different creatures. Even all of the allegations of racist bullying being made against Nigel Farage at the moment didn't happen when he was in power, when he was in a political position, power over a country or just power over your own party. But Donald Trump took to his own social media platform yesterday to respond to the reported murder of Rob Reiner, objectively one of the finest film directors ever. We ran through some of his hits yesterday. I'll run through them again, lest you... And these are just the ones he directed. He was also, connected to and associated with various productions that he didn't actually direct. But you've got The Princess Bride, you've got When Harry Met Sally, you've got A Few Good Men, you've got Spinal Tap, you've got a couple of others as well that will come to me. Well, you'll text them to me in about 5 seconds. And it is the most extraordinary CV, the most extraordinary roster of successes. And him and his wife, Michelle, were found dead in their home on Sunday night. Their own son, Nick, has subsequently been arrested for the murder. But Donald Trump took to social media to say the following. A very sad thing happened last night in Hollywood. Rob Reiner, a tortured and struggling but once very talented movie director and comedy star, has passed away, together with his wife, Michelle, reportedly due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding and incurable affliction with a mind-crippling disease known as Trump Derangement Syndrome, sometimes referred to as TDS. He was known to have driven people crazy by his raging obsession of President Donald J. Trump, with his obvious paranoia reaching new heights as the Trump administration surpassed all goals and expectations of greatness, and with the golden age of America upon us, perhaps like never before. May Rob and Michelle rest in peace! Exclamation mark. I can't unwrap that. I can shout words at it. I can shout words at you. But I can't unwrap that. You know that even with people who you don't admire, Misery and Stand By Me were the other two films. He was also involved with The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile. I can't unpack it at all. And I hate that feeling. You know I do. I hate just being completely baffled by something. Baffled, discombobulated. Just looking at something and thinking, the more I look at it, the more likely I am to understand it. The more we work together, the more we worry at something together. You know, you worry at a problem. That's the figure of speech. The more time we spend unpicking something, the more likely we are to unpick it. But this is hideous. Two people have just been murdered. And I couldn't even put into words at the moment what he thinks he's achieving by doing. I couldn't even put into words what he thinks he's doing. Is he dancing on Rob Reiner's grave? He is, right? He's dancing on. And do you remember the reactions from Donald Trump supporters when Charlie Kirk was murdered? And people who, I mean, in my case, people who simply played out footage of Charlie Kirk saying things, speaking. Came in for some criticism for not being suitably respectful, I think. I forget precisely what. Some people went too far for polite society. But for the President of the United States to dance upon the grave of a recently murdered man and a recently murdered woman with a succession of lies, not just about the circumstances of the murder, but also about the state of his own administration. It is, what's the word? What word would you use? I've got, there's a press conference in the Oval Office later where he effectively doubled down on this. We should probably have a little listen to that as well at some point. But what word would you use? Can you do it in a single word? You don't have to ring in with a single word. You can text it to 84850 or you can WhatsApp it to 03456060973. Grotesque. But grotesque could describe a picture. It goes deeper than grotesque. It is genuinely, and I'm always wary of posting anything or tweeting anything or saying anything that involves the phrase, I'm not often lost for words, but, because then you run the risk of somebody else pointing out that you've claimed that you're not often lost for words on at least 30 occasions. But I am obviously not often lost for words. It's what I do. I have this extraordinary job where I can come on air in the morning and tell you that I'm lost for words. And then, lo and behold, it turns out that I'm not, because once I start talking, words come out. But I haven't said anything yet. I've said words, but I'm lost for words to properly describe what I just read to you. I'm genuinely lost for words. And I don't know anymore whether it matters that this won't affect the people that think they like him or the people that think that he's on their side. I don't know whether it matters that he could shoot someone, yada, 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 Fifth Avenue, not lose a single vote. I think I find the absolute absence of humanity really chilling. But again, I'm lost for words. Chilling? What does chilling mean? What's chilling? Films are chilling, you know? This is the president. This is the crucial point you need to take on board before you tell me what you think is going on. The president of the United States of America, you know the old phrases, the man with the nuclear codes. The lying is now absolutely normal, right? The administration reaching new heights, surpassing all goals and expectations of greatness. The golden age of America upon us. Maybe people still suck this up. Maybe people still swallow this nonsense. But anybody capable of counting knows that none of that is true. But that's baked in now. That's part of our calculations. That's part of our shared reality. The president of the United States of America tells lies like it's going out of fashion. He calls the truth fake news and he calls lies alternative facts. He's been doing that since he got into the White House. And unfortunately, that song has been sung. Didn't matter. Nobody cared. On he goes. But this, a man, I mean, still in the mortuary. His son under arrest for his murder, a son who's had well-documented problems with drugs and his own mental health. And the president of the United States of America gets his phone out and types this. A very sad thing happened last night in Hollywood. Rob Reiner, a tortured and struggling but once very talented movie director and comedy star, has passed away together with his wife Michelle, reportedly due to the anger he caused others, is the first lie, through his massive, unyielding and incurable affection with a mind-crippling disease known as Trump derangement syndrome. As we've said a few times, that is a phrase only used by people who are defending the indefensible and trying to pretend that the real problem lies with the people describing and condemning the indefensible. He was known to have driven people crazy by his raging obsession of President Donald J. Trump, with his obvious paranoia reaching new heights as the Trump administration surpassed all goals and expectations of greatness, and with the golden age of America upon us, perhaps like never before, may Rob and Michelle rest in peace. I mean, listen, none of us, well, you might, I don't have the qualifications to undertake any form of diagnosis here. I know that Rob Reiner was, many years ago, he talked about, well, about 4 years ago, he talked about a TV project he was doing called The Spy and the Asset, which would look at the relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. I don't know what became of that, but it might, there might be a personal animus in place here. How on earth did the director of When Harry Met Sally get so far under the president's skin that even by his standards, he's taken complete leave of his senses in a public forum? So that might be part of the answer to the question, but what on earth is happening here? It's the only question I've got for you. Let's see if you're any better than me at putting it into words. He was given an opportunity to, I don't know, withdraw, reverse, rethink, apologise, and he instead did this.
A number of Republicans have denounced your statement on Truth Social after the murder of Rob Reiner. Do you stand by that post?
Well, I wasn't a fan of his at all. He was a deranged person as far as Trump is concerned. He said he knew it was false. In fact, it's the exact opposite, that I was a friend of Russia, controlled by Russia. You know, it was the Russia hoax. He was one of the people behind it. I think he hurt himself in career-wise. So he became like a deranged person, Trump derangement syndrome. So I was not a fan of Rob Reiner at all in any way, shape or form. I thought he was very bad for our country. Yeah.
And you'll remember the reaction when Charlie Kirk died and people criticized him. And Donald Trump fans were at the forefront of people were threatened with deportation for not being sufficiently respectful. Absolutely shocking. And oddly, when Charlie Kirk died, Rob Reiner expressed his shock and sadness at it, saying it should never happen to anybody. It's beyond belief what happened to him. He described his absolute horror at seeing the events that unfolded, adding, "I don't care what your political beliefs are. That's not acceptable. That's not a solution to solving problems." And then he gets murdered, and Donald Trump, he just dances on his grave. But that's a figure of speech. It's not an explanation. What happened there? What's happening here? What exactly do you think is going on that such hideousness can be disseminated from such a high position? 0345 6060973. Why did Donald Trump do this? And I'll take any answer you've got, because I'm dashed if I know. Hit the numbers now, you will get through. 0345 6060973. And Simon Marks is with us at 12:30 as well, so no doubt he'll have something to add to this as well.
This is LBC.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Sky Sports will play more than 50 Premier League games and the PDC Darts Championship. While over on Sky TV, Amadeus and Sweet Pea, Stranger Things is on Netflix.
Get Sky Sports, Sky TV and Netflix for a most wonderful price in time for Christmas. Go to sky.com. Sky, believe in better. Requires Sky Stream and relevant Sky TV subscriptions. Minimum broadband speed of 25 megabits per second recommended. 18 plus.
Oh, hey, last minute gifters. At TK Maxx, you can shop fashionably late with big brand gifts arriving right up to Christmas Eve. There's loads in store. So if you're shopping for your bestie, gran or pooch, there's still time to spoil all your loved ones for less. Big gifts, small prices, in store, online and on the TK Maxx app now.
Same.
Ho, ho, ho!
Same.
3, 2, 1, hey!
Same.
Whoa, thanks.
Same.
What does Santa call his dog?
Same. Same.
One word. Three syllables.
Same. Same.
Sorry, it's a bit dry.
New plates.
Ooh.
Treat your table to something different this Christmas. Visit your local IKEA now. IKEA, the wonderful every day.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060 973.
Tony, 1 minute after 12, we didn't really hesitate to wonder whether Joe Biden was ill, did we? Or whether his cognitive function was in decline. It was pretty hard to avoid evidence that things weren't very rosy when he did that presidential debate or that election debate with Donald Trump. But, I mean, one answer I'd come up with in answer to what on earth is going on in this message Donald Trump posted about the murder of Rob Reiner, I would say to you, I'd ask you, do you think he might be very ill? But I don't know. Ross is in Bangor in Northern Ireland. Ross, what would you like to say?
Morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good. What's going on here? It's the weirdest thing, right? I'm not exaggerating. Even by his standards, this is gross.
Isn't it one of these moments where you look up a word in the dictionary and then it says Trump, which is the word sociopathic? There's no other word for what's happened here.
What does that mean?
Well, it means he's got no empathy. He doesn't know how other people feel. So he shows no kindness. He doesn't understand what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. He has no remorse all the words that you would find to define a sociopath are summed up in that message that he wrote about Rob Reiner. And to be honest, this is deja vu, isn't it, James? How many times have we been round this block with Donald Trump?
Quite a few. I don't. Why does this one seem to slap harder? I mean, we go back to the quote's greatest hits, don't we? Of when he mocked the disabled journalist, when he insulted the family of the Gold Star military veteran. There'll be other ones that we can't really remember. The way he's spoken about women, the way he's spoken about political rivals, former allies, the way he's spoken about the BBC. Well, that's less does it not feel worse to you, this, in some way? Can it be worse than, like, literally physically mocking a disabled journalist?
I don't think it is. I think it's just another touch point.
Rob Reiner's dead. He's dead. He's been murdered, mate. It is worse. Yes. It's the worst he's ever done, this, I think.
It's just a terrible example of his behaviour, but it all comes back to the same thing, that he has no understanding of how other people feel at all. None of his...
I see, I disagree with that. He must have a sort of... Yeah, he must have a diabolical grasp of how people feel, because he feeds... No. He gets elected after essentially inciting an insurrection against his own seat of government. He understands some people implicitly, better than any other politician of our age.
As long as it suits his purpose, this is the point, that everything comes back to him. The world revolves around Donald Trump. Everything revolves around him, whether that's the death of an actor who he didn't agree with, whether it's for him to get into power, or for him to better himself and better his money, like he's suing over the BBC. I know you've moved on from that this morning.
No, I haven't. It's still front and centre.
But that's just another moment, isn't it, where he's just trying to get more for him.
Yeah, but I can get my head around that. I can explain that. I could give a TED talk on why he's suing the BBC. I can't. I mean, and respectfully, your brushstrokes are very broad and they would apply to all manner of behaviours. This goes further than anything I can remember him doing. And perhaps that is the explanation, is this... The Russia stuff, and that seems to be where he is at his most thin-skinned and his most frightened, doesn't it? And when he's frightened, he lashes out. So it would
or
be
Epstein.
Epstein's of course, which is also
so
on
Russia
the agenda
and Epstein are the two
week.
Buttons we can push, aren't they? We could keep pushing the Epstein button. In fact, let's have that. Let's say that again today. Can we get those? Can we get that list published?
They're supposed to. They're supposed to release everything by Friday. That's a shame.
I would have drip fed it because it annoys him. I would have built one out a week for every week of his presidency just to annoy him because it really gets under his skin.
It seems to, and if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. But we don't. We're not going to come up. I mean, I'll take sociopath. Obviously, that's a word that seems to fit the available parameters. I can't remember. Thank you, Russ. Take care. I can't remember the questions we used to ask when we thought that this was unravelable. Or, and this is the really sad thing, when we thought that eventually everybody would see the light. For me, that day was January the 6th. That's so mad looking back. I thought that would be the moment where people who had people in this country who had cheered him or facilitated him or had said, don't worry about what he says, just focus on what he does. I honestly thought that when January the 6th come round, I wasn't expecting written letters of apology or to get my job on Newsnight back or anything like that, but I honestly thought that people who had used the phrase Trump derangement syndrome would just not apologise, but just shut up for a while. I honestly thought that. I thought January the 6th would be the moment where everybody went, yeah, he was as bad as everybody said he was. And well, you know what happened next. He got back into the White House. So I don't do those phone-ins anymore. I don't ask those questions anymore. The questions that are predicated by a presumption that eventually everybody would agree with what is obvious, as in the innate awfulness of this human being, of this politician, crucially. So I don't expect to unravel that. But what was he doing here? What was he doing when he decided not just to write this, which is mad enough, but to press send? That's the bit that I think is hardest to grasp. A man has been murdered, and the President of the United States is celebrating. He is dead. He is making it about himself. He is lying about the circumstances of the murder, the motive for the murder, as far as we know, because their son, Michelle and Rob Reiner's son, Nick, has been arrested on suspicion of murder. Rob Reiner is dead. Donald Trump is lying about him, lying about his murder, lying about his life, lying about his own administration. And the body hasn't been It's, I mean, to coin a phrase, the body isn't yet cold. What? Why is he doing this? What is he doing? Is that the question? What is he doing? 0345 6060 973. Tony's in Greenock. Tony, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Thanks for taking the call. I think he's legitimising the reaction of his base. He's echoing what his base have been saying online about Rob Reiner. And by him saying it, it kind of legitimises what they're saying, rather than there being outrage from people about it.
Were they saying that after he died?
Yes.
Right.
Very much so. Some of the reaction, some of the comments, I mean, I'm unfortunate. Well, not unfortunate. I remain on X.
Sure.
Some of the comments on X about Rob Reiner were just awful. Absolutely awful. They're celebrating the demise of this man. And as I was saying to your producer there, I think he himself celebrates the demise of his critics. And the higher profile, the more he celebrates it, because these people clearly have, you know, they're allowed to criticize, should be allowed to criticize him, but in Trump world...
You're not allowed to criticize. So these people celebrating it would be the sort of self-appointed champions of free speech who wanted people deported for not being suitably respectful of Charlie Kirk after he was murdered.
Exactly.
Rob Reiner, whose crime is to, in their eyes, is to offer very kind of thoughtful and evidence-based analyses of Trump's conduct. You're not allowed to criticize him. And if you criticize him... This perhaps is a message he's sending to people. If you criticise Donald Trump, you deserve to die.
Well, he would celebrate your death. He wouldn't bemoan the fact you're dead. He would make your death about him, rather than about the fact that you're actually dead. You know.
So, as someone who's obviously paid a little bit, well, quite a lot more attention to elements of this than I have by dint of the platforms that I'm on and not on. Reiner really got to him, and he hadn't actually done much. He'd engaged in some fairly obvious, not obvious, some fairly thoughtful criticism, and there were rumours of a television project, but as far as I'm aware, that's not imminent or in the can or anything like that, but he really, really got to Trump.
Because of his profile. He's high-profile Hollywood.
It's successful critics he hates the most, isn't it? People who are literally the best in the world at what they do, because he knows... Mm-hmm. That he's not. So you take one of the finest film directors in the history of cinema, who can see Trump for exactly what he is. He's hold up a mirror. Mm-hmm. The bigger you are, the better you are, the more powerful your mirror becomes for somebody as craven as Trump. You hold up the mirror, Trump sees himself in it, and he tries to smash the mirror and dance on your grave when you die.
That's pretty much the way I'm looking at it.
12:30 is the time. That works. That fits. I'm not quite as lost for words as I was at the beginning of this conversation, but there is room for a heck of a lot more. 0345 6060 973 is the number you need, although Simon Marks is due after the very latest headlines with Amelia Cox.
The surviving gunman in the Bondi Beach terror attack is believed to have woken from his coma. 24-year-old Navid Akram is still receiving treatment in a hospital in Sydney under police guard. Volodymyr Zelensky says talks with the US on reaching a peace deal with Russia could be finalised within days, but the Ukrainian president has warned some territorial issues are still unresolved. And Britain's jobs market showed further signs of weakening in the lead-up to last month's budget. Official figures show the unemployment rate rose to 5.1%, its highest level since early 2021. LBC weather, mostly cloudy today in the southeast with spells of rain. Northwest Scotland will be windy with further showers, largely dry elsewhere with cloud and hazy sunshine, a high of 12 degrees.
LBC. Tonight's Euro Millions jackpot is £14 million.
I think that deserves a whoop whoop. Whoop whoop! Thank you, faraway person. Get in tonight's Euro Millions draw. Play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Protect your pets over this festive period. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk and enjoy Christmas covered.
What makes the best roast dinner is deeply personal. And we've all got strong opinions on whether it's best with beef or chicken, roasties or mash, and if cauliflower cheese really belongs. It doesn't, by the way. But one thing isn't up for debate. A roast is always better with deliciously crispy, fluffy Paxo stuffing. Mmm. A roast isn't a roast without Paxo, the original stuffing. Lovingly crafted since 1901.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to...
Stay out all night! Yoo-hoo!
That's brilliant. So, OK, sales targets. Are we hitting...
The dance floor! Party time! Woo-hoo!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2 for 1, you can choose glasses for at least two yous. From £70 with standard single vision lenses.
Nice moves, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirement for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 12:34. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. The man responsible for that hideous incident in Liverpool, who drove his car into a crowd of people, is currently being sentenced. Updates on that story as and when they occur. But we turn next to Washington DC, where Simon Marks awaits. And once again, it feels like a doctor's waiting room sometimes, this. We're here to diagnose Donald Trump's latest behaviour. Where would you like to start, Simon? With the BBC writ?
I was actually going to start with Rob Reiner, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Why is Trump doing what he's done, do you think?
Well, just to answer the question that you were asking before the break, what is Donald Trump doing here? Yeah. I think Donald Trump yesterday here dramatically overplayed his hand. If you go to Truth Social, where he published that message yesterday, shamefully and disgracefully sullying his own office,
yes,
by expressing the very hostile sentiments that he expressed to both Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle Singer Reiner, look at the responses, and you will discover that a substantial number of Donald Trump's followers from his Make America Great Again movement urged him to delete that message,
wow,
said to him that it was inappropriate. We saw yesterday here not a single Republican lawmaker up on Capitol Hill willing to back what he was saying. The only person I could find yesterday who was going to bat for that disgraceful message was the far-right influencer Laura Luma,
right,
who herself is no stranger to inflammatory, irresponsible messaging. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, walked away from reporters when they questioned him about it. He didn't even do what he normally does, which is to say, oh, I didn't read it, the President's got a sense of humour. We didn't hear any of that. I think this was of a much bigger magnitude than, for instance, the shameful comments that he made several years ago about, yeah, Serge Kovaleski, the New York Times reporter, yeah, who is disabled. Because Rob Reiner and his wife had a huge constituency of followers among the Democratic Party faithful. But they also had enormous fans outside the Democratic Party's base. You know, who doesn't love When Harry Met Sally, mm, or This Is Spinal Tap, or all the other great films that Rob Reiner directed? It's also important to talk about his wife, Michelle,
yes,
Singer Reiner, for a couple of different reasons. First of all, before she married Rob Reiner, she was a photographer. And she happens to have been the photographer who took the famous cover picture of Donald Trump that appears on the Art of the Deal. Now, whether Donald Trump remembered that yesterday before he put that shocking message out or not is unclear.
Wow.
But not only did they have that personal history, but after she married Rob Reiner, just last year, she was one of the co-producers of a documentary called God and Country. And it really stuck in the craw of the Christian nationalists that documentary exposed and investigated, that absolutely lie at the heart of Trump's second term. That documentary, if you go and watch it, and if you haven't seen it, it is well worth a view. God and Country. You can find it streaming on one of the streaming services somewhere. That lifted the lid on the Christian national movement and said to Americans, these people are going to take the country down exactly the path that Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, and all of the sycophants within the administration have taken America down since Inauguration Day back in January. So there was definitely personal animus towards her and to Rob Reiner, who also worked on that project and, of course, raised millions of dollars for political candidates, including Kamala Harris, before her former President Barack Obama, and was an acolyte, you know, a hero of the Democratic Party and progressive causes. But I think he overplayed his hand yesterday, even with his own support base.
And I swore off this question probably 6 or 7 months ago, and now you've made me ask you again. Is it likely to change anything, the support base notwithstanding, or will we back to business as usual in a week?
I mean, we may be back to business as usual in a week. There were many Trump supporters, I mean, they claimed to be Trump's voters, who were saying on social media yesterday, Mr. President, I voted for you 3 times, but I am deeply, deeply disappointed by this message. You know, the thing about that message is, it is so profoundly un-American. Mm. I mean, it flies in the face. We're about to celebrate next year America's 250th birthday. It flies in the face of every tradition here, of not dancing on the graves of your political opponents. People, I mean, in times gone by, presidents who disagreed politically with Rob Reiner and his wife would nonetheless have put out a presidential statement paying tribute to the extraordinary contributions that they made to American society and American life.
And they would have meant
life.
It.
Now,
and,
all of
and,
that.
And they would have meant it.
And they would have meant it, yeah. Because they would have been acting in their role not as head of government, but as head of state. Yes. Remember, the American presidency combines the two roles. Now, all of that went out of the window during Trump's first term. The presidential tributes to Americans of note who passed away disappeared. And to be fair about this, Joe Biden never really brought it back. Mm. So if you look at the people that Joe Biden paid tribute to, they were invariably people with whom he had an affinity, particularly ideologically and philosophically. So that era has gone. But this is such an egregious, disgraceful, shameful moment for the presidency in terms of that role as head of state, that I think there are hardworking Americans out there, doesn't matter what political party they back, who look at that and they say, you know what, that is profoundly un-American.
Yeah, I mean, to say the very least, it is hideous, almost incomprehensibly hideous, but thank you. Clearly the position that Reiner adopted and Singer Reiner and Michelle adopted was part of the reason why they had collectively burrowed so far under his skin, which I suppose brings us
definitely
to the BBC. I don't sense that the BBC have burrowed under his skin anywhere near as much as Rob Reiner did. This lawsuit feels a little more opportunistic perhaps than that hideous sort of bilious outburst yesterday.
Yeah, and there's a curiosity about the timing of this lawsuit. It has been over a month since Donald Trump first threatened to sue the BBC. And we're very used to Donald Trump making all sorts of threats to sue all sorts of people, and most of them he doesn't follow through on. So I was thinking last week, you know, maybe this thing has gone away. Mm. Maybe the lawyers spent more than a month trying to figure out if they had any legal justification for bringing this lawsuit whatsoever. Even, you know, especially in the Sunshine State of Florida. And then suddenly yesterday, and it was out of the blue at the White House after some event in which he pinned medals on people from his border force for doing all sorts of brave things, apparently, in keeping immigrants out of the country. Yeah. After that, suddenly he went off on a riff and told us that the lawsuit was imminent. Let's take a listen to what he said yesterday at the Oval Office.
In a little while, you'll be seeing I'm suing the BBC for putting words in my mouth. Literally, they put words in my mouth. They had me saying things that I never said coming out. I guess they used AI or something. So we'll be bringing that lawsuit. A lot of people are asking, when are you bringing that lawsuit? Even the media can't believe that one. They actually put terrible words in my mouth having to do with January 6th that I didn't say. And the beautiful words that I said, right? The beautiful words, talking about patriotism and all of the good things that I said, they didn't say that, but they put terrible words They actually have me speaking with words that I never said.
And then, of course, late last night, that lawsuit drops and it's been filed in the Southern Division of the U.S. District Court in Miami. And if you read all 33 pages of it, I think that there will be many legal analysts who think that it is very thin legal gruel. I mean, he's suing the BBC, demanding $5 billion for defamation and $5 billion for breaching the Florida Deceptive Trading Practices Act. The lawsuit is unable to identify a single viewer in Florida who watched the documentary, complained about it, and then changed their vote as a result of viewing it. Instead, if you read the lawsuit, the BBC is presented, who knew, as this broadcasting powerhouse in Florida, with its content available to millions of Floridians whom apparently it influenced. Buried in this lawsuit is the evidence of the president's star witness, no less an authority, this is the wording of the lawsuit, than former Prime Minister Liz Truss.
This changes everything.
According to the... changes everything, right? She discussed the bias, the need to hold the BBC accountable, and the BBC's pattern of actual malice. It complains about the words used by many analysts that were interviewed by the BBC, including the former Labour Secretary Robert Reich, Heather Cox Richardson, the politics professor at Boston College. It even complains about the fact that it took a clip of the BBC News coverage of Kamala Harris's convention speech in Chicago last year. And it complains about the fact that the sound is brought up of a BBC reporter or presenter saying that the mood in the room as she took to the stage was electric. Now, all of that is going to be completely covered by America's First Amendment, which guarantees freedom of speech. And notably, this lawsuit doesn't quote any of the myriad Trump supporters who were given free rein during the course of that hour-long documentary to explain why they were backing him for a second term. And as we've noted before, the day after that documentary was transmitted, television critics in the newspapers back there in the UK all hailed it for having avoided the trap of using a sledgehammer to crack a nut and having actually given Trump supporters an opportunity to explain why they wanted him back in the White House. So, look, I think it's eminently defensible. I know there are calls for him to on the BBC to settle this in short order and get rid of it. But I think they've got a real chance. I mean, it may be that the judge simply looks at the complaint, and as a previous judge did with the complaint against the New York Times for $15 billion, just throws the complaint out and says there's no merit to the complaint. But let's see where it goes.
Is it? I mean, listening to him there, I just read the first line because people may not have seen it. This action concerns... I don't know, have you ever been on a pound a word, Simon, when you've been writing for newspapers? or you've been writing an essay?
Not a pound, mate.
Not a pound a word. Well, you've been watching the word count in the top right-hand corner of the screen and just waiting to get over the line so you could go to the pub. That's what this reads like. This action concerns a false, defamatory, deceptive, disparaging, inflammatory and malicious depiction of President Trump. I think they've run out of adjectives. But... again, you've done it again. You've tempted me back into trying to sort of doing the cryptology of Trump. In that clip you played, it sounds like he's not actually quite clear about what he's accusing the BBC of. He sounds as if he thinks it was an AI depiction of him saying words that he never said, where it is, and actually in the writ, they don't put the correct edit in. They remove quite a large chunk that appears between the two clips that were spliced together by the BBC. So again, that would undermine a case you'd imagine in a normal law court. But he doesn't seem to understand what he's accusing the BBC of in that clip.
Yeah, we should be absolutely clear. There is no connectivity between what Donald Trump said in the Oval Office yesterday and what the lawsuit alleges. I mean, we know, whether he knows it or not, we know the BBC did not put words into his mouth. They took two parts of the speech, jammed them together inappropriately, and didn't disclose to the audience that that's what they'd done. They certainly didn't use, as he keeps inferring, and he's done this on numerous occasions, they certainly didn't use AI literally to put words into his mouth. And the lawsuit doesn't assert that at all. So those claims are not being advanced legally. And the lawsuit, I mean, you know, this thing runs 33 pages. When the judge down in Florida, a Republican appointee, dismissed the complaint against the New York Times, he made the point that when you bring these defamation lawsuits, the complaints themselves are required to be short, to the point, and very, very clearly identify why the alleged crime aggrieved someone in the jurisdiction in which the alleged behavior took place. This is another one of these lengthy, bilious legal documents that chucks everything, including the kitchen sink, into the language, refers to Donald Trump's brand as one of the world's great business leaders. You know, the courts have previously shown in Florida they don't have any truck with that kind of stuff, and it may well be that on this occasion they don't have much truck with this if they choose to go forward to a trial. As I say, so much of the BBC's alleged conduct, alleged misconduct, looks at first glance as though it's entirely covered by the First Amendment, that they've got the opportunity, I think, to put up a very vigorous defence. And by the way, so does the British government, if the British government chooses to say to Donald Trump, get your mitts off my public broadcaster. Mm.
I mean, they could even countersue, but that would be too much to wish
for. Yes, they could.
As indeed would...
Well, they could, definitely.
Yeah, an appearance from Liz Truss in the witness box I would actually put on pay-per-view, I think, Simon. thank you. I mean, it's all there, isn't it? It's all unfolding, and as ever, you managed to steer a fairly clear course through the madness for us. So thank you very much indeed for that, Simon Marks, live from Washington, D.C. I'm yet to present a programme that would not be adorned by the presence of Simon Marks, but some days it's even more valuable, of course, than others. I make some sense of that if you can. The sentencing of the so-called Liverpool parade attacker is underway as we speak. If there are any conclusions to that process before Sheila gets here, I'll bring them to you immediately, or at least after this.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
From Bondi to Britain, just how big is the threat from violent jihadism? President Trump and the BBC. And did a slave make your Christmas decorations?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Tonight's Euro Millions jackpot is £14 million.
I think that deserves a whoop whoop. Whoop whoop!
Thank you, faraway person. Get in tonight's Euro Millions draw. Play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to...
Stay out all night! Yahoo!
That's brilliant. So, OK, sales targets. Are we hitting...
The dance floor! Party time! Woohoo!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2-for-1, you can choose glasses for at least two use. From £70 with standard single-vision lenses.
Nice move, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last. Subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirements for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need, to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
Protect your pets over this festive period. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk and enjoy Christmas covered.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped
for the content production industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Daisy, a technical content production student in year 12.
We've already learned how to create content and work with employers in the media industry. I love working in the studio, making my own podcast, and can't wait to start my 45-day work placement next term.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It is 12:53. I've got a new game, a Whisper Watch. And in fact, it comes from the same brain, a rather splendid, not speaking about all my favourite people on social media today, a chap called Roland Smith, who is a sort of refugee from Tufton Street, a very good, provides very good critiques of Brexit as well. And I think it was him that drew my attention to Unhinged Headlines first on his account. And he's identified a new craze on the outer reaches, the lunatic fringe of the Daily Telegraph. And were I to turn it into a radio feature, I would call it Whisper Watch, because he's collated a succession, a veritable series of headlines that all begin with the words, whisper it. Whisper it. So it essentially is a way of writing something bonkers and pretending that it's an insight. So today you have Theresa Villiers. Do you remember her? Theresa Villiers has written under the headline, Whisper It, but Badenoch is dragging the Conservatives back from the brink. To which the only correct response is, Whisper It, but the opinion polls say that she isn't. And then you go back a little further, and you've got, this is from someone called Camilla Tominey, Whisper It, but Rishi Sunak is making an extraordinary comeback. So it's a bit like what Donald Trump does, isn't it? It's like, if we can get it into a headline, maybe it will become true, even though it obviously isn't true at the time that we're writing the article. This is from someone called David Blair. Whisper it, but it's just possible that sanity is returning to US diplomacy. Imagine putting your name to that. Another one from Jeremy Warner. Whisper it, but Labour is about to inherit a rallying economy. And then shortly afterwards, whisper it, but here comes a 1920s-style post-pandemic boom. I mean, who wouldn't keep him on the payroll? Here's one from someone called Fraser Nelson. Whisper it, but I'm beginning to see how Boris just might survive this. Tom Harris, whisper it, but Labour is now saying that Thatcher and Truss were right. Whisper it, says someone called Lucy Denyer, but millions of people are enjoying lockdown. It could go on, but I can't face any more. So there's another one. Should we start Whisper Watch? Should we start Whisper Watch? Would we get a thing for that? Could we? No, why not? Why can't I do it myself? Whisper Watch. There you go, Rick. It'll take 6 months. And of course, they'll stop doing it again. Like, they stopped printing the Unhinged Headlines just as Unhinged Headlines got up and running. So well spotted, Roland. Whisper it, but the Daily Telegraph is still as mad as a box of frogs, even though they've stopped running the Unhinged Headlines that we had so much fun with together. Speaking of Unhinged, Greg's in Brighton. Not you, Greg. Donald Trump. What's going on?
Hi, James. Well, hello. I think, effectively, we've got something which is just partly about strategy. Trump and his team from day one have had a very clear strategy to upset liberals at yes. any cost. And I think here he's absolutely overstepped the mark by what Simon was saying. Yeah.
Because Reiner had got so far under his skin, perhaps, that his normally fairly impressive judgment of exactly where the lines of what he can and can't get away with are, he's lost sight of it for once.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is where his sociopathy and strategy sort of have met in a mutated form and really blown him out the water. It's such a, you know, hideous things to say, but it has upset liberals, so perhaps even in his own terms, he's sitting there in the office with his colleagues saying, what's the problem?
He's also upset quite a lot of non-liberals, as Simon rather splendidly Absolutely. Pointing out, wading through the replies on Truth Social so that you don't have to, Greg, and even more importantly, so that I don't have to. I wonder whether the BBC writ is a consequence of him realising that he's overstepped the mark. So you have a kind of... it's a bit like whenever Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss used to mention Jeremy Corbyn at PMQs, you knew that they were a little bit desperate because Corbyn had been gone for ages, but they'd still bring him up at PMQs. And it was as if it was an in case of emergency break glass. And yesterday, Trump had a bit of an emergency after seeing the reaction to his hideous comments about Rob Reiner and Michelle Singer Reiner. And he broke the glass and all he had in there was a writ against the BBC. Oh, crikey, I thought, right, let's sue them.
disparaging, deceitful, dishonest, disgusting, and here's my star witness, Liz Truss. It's not something you'd reach for except in an emergency, is it? I don't know. Last word on this to James, who's in Brockworth. James, what do you reckon?
Hello, James.
Hello, James.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Well, I agree, James.
Yeah. I was ringing up basically to try and make sense of Trump.
Good
which
luck.
I'm sure many people have tried to do. But basically, I speak from a position of being the son of someone who's got narcissistic personality disorder.
Oh, crikey, I'm sorry.
And, yeah, I've not had any communication with my father for a decade now.
Wow.
And having researched into what might have gone wrong generally, narcissistic personality disorder was what came to the front. I see all the same traits in Donald Trump as I do in my own father. That inability to empathize, everything's about him.
Yes.
And also just listening to Simon's clip where he was saying, oh, I didn't do all this. There's that whole acronym that's used to describe people with NPD, which is DARVO.
Oh, yes.
Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, denial. Go on, run me through it again.
Yeah. So you've got denial, so denying something ever happened.
Yeah.
Attack, which is how dare you say this about me. And then reversal of victim and offender.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden they become the victim. And basically this latest heinous thing he's put down is just another example of him unable to see empathy, make it all about himself. And now, of course, with the BBC, it goes back to DARVO, which is all to do with NPD, narcissistic personality disorder.
I like it. I don't like it, but I like the analysis. I'll tell you something else someone has said, which is quite clever, is that in many ways, Rob Reiner had done to Donald Trump what Tom Cruise's character did to Jack Nicholson's character in A Few Good Men, in that they got so far under his skin that his head exploded, which could explain what we witnessed on True Social yesterday. Horrible, horrible, horrible. Just sometimes you just have to stop and point that out, even if it is all part of an almost overwhelming tidal wave of filth emerging from a politician or an office. You just stop and say, that's just gross. We're all better than that. Regardless of everything else we might disagree with, we're all better than that. You don't dance on the grave of dead film directors. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player, or indeed on the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinions, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily. It's Gareth Southgate this week on Full Disclosure. It's an absolute doozy. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick. But now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you, James. I'm going to be talking more about President Trump and the BBC heading to court at 3. But as I speak, the sentencing statements of Judge Andrew Menery, KC, are taking place in the case of Paul Doyle, the Liverpool man who drove into a crowd of Liverpool fans some months ago. We'll bring you the outcome of that when the sentencing arrives. The sentencing remarks are pretty striking, I must say. Two, the question of the impact of anti-Semitic chants and slogans on the safety of Jews is front and centre again, not least because of Bondi. But I'm going to start with a question of just how seriously we, the public and the police and security services, are taking extremism, ISIS and the like. There's a Philippines ISIS link in the Bondi case.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. It's understood one of the surviving suspects in the Bondi Beach terror attack has woken from a coma and is speaking to police. His father was shot dead by officers responding to the attack, which led to the deaths of 15 people on Sunday. Counter-terror police are looking into reports they received training in the Philippines. Lizzie Pearl is a journalist with Sydney's Nine News.
In that vehicle that they drove to Bondi Beach in on Sunday afternoon, there were two IS flags and a lot of homemade IEDs as well. So the terror links are being investigated right now by Australian Counter-Terrorism Police. It's also being investigated a trip that this father and son made to the Philippines in recent weeks. So why they went there, who they met with, what the purpose of that visit is now a very big focus.
Volodymyr Zelensky says a peace deal with Russia could be finalised within days, but warned some territorial issues are still unresolved. He described the proposal put forward by the US as very workable. Meanwhile, the UK is investing £600 million in Ukrainian air defence capabilities to help Kyiv shoot down drones. Defence Secretary John Healey is chairing a meeting of Ukraine supporting countries and says he's taking nothing for granted.
Putin continues his brutal attacks on Ukraine. So we must step up. We must step up our support still further to put pressure on Putin to do a deal, but also to protect the Ukrainians during the winter months.
Latest figures show the UK's unemployment rate rose to 5.1% in the 3 months to October. It's up from 5% in the previous quarter and the highest level since January 2021. There was also another fall in the number of staff on company payrolls. The BBC says it will defend itself against a $10 billion lawsuit filed by Donald Trump. The US president's lawyers claim the broadcaster maliciously sought to mislead voters by editing his speech to supporters ahead of the Capitol riots. He's accused the corporation of defamation and violating a trade practices law. And it's emerged thousands of speeding fines on England's motorways and A roads have been issued in error. National Highways says the very small number of drivers affected will be reimbursed with any penalty points removed. It's after a fault was found with some speed cameras. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 48 points at 97.02. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather, mostly cloudy today in the southeast with spells of rain. Northwest Scotland will be windy with further showers, largely dry elsewhere with cloud and hazy sunshine, a high of 12 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Imagine a place where you can escape for a day. Get immersed in a world of rooms, inspiration and expertise. Where you can laze in luxury accommodation. And kids can feast from 95 pence. Tickets are free to everyone and include all the attractions. You've just imagined a day out at IKEA. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I'm just keeping a close eye on Liverpool Crown Court, where Paul Doyle, the man who rammed his car into Liverpool football fans some months ago, is facing his sentencing imminently. The judge in the case is giving his quite extensive sentencing remarks, and we will give you the detail of those plus the sentence when it comes a little later this hour. He's just come in. He's got 21 and a half years. That's an expectedly tough sentence, 21 and a half years. We'll get a report on that from Liam Gotting, LBC's reporter, a little later in about 10 minutes' time. And it's worth saying that from some of the sentencing remarks and the detail that's been given out, I'm giving an early health warning on some of the detail that will be in Liam's report, because the judge went into great detail about the injuries and the victims and the impact on them. And he made the very important statement very clearly that while Paul Doyle tried to blame events on pressure from the crowd, the judge said all evidence shows that the crowd was doing everything in its power to either stop him or get out of his way. So we'll get more detail on that. 21 and a half years for Paul Doyle, who rammed Liverpool fans after those Champions League celebrations. Before that, though, let's turn our attention again to Bondi, the attack on Bondi, the implications of it, not least still up close and personal for the people of Australia, the people of Bondi and the Jewish community in particular, but the implications that it has for the wider world when it comes to how we tackle the threat of this kind of violence, anti-Semitic, Islamist, in all likelihood, violence perpetrated on the beach at the weekend. It's been reported by the police in Australia this morning that the two men being investigated, one dead, one still in hospital, took a trip to the Philippines in the month before Sunday's shooting, and there are reports that they visited to receive military-style training. Again, on Sunday morning when this story first emerged and images of the shooting, particularly the younger man shooting from the bridge, emerged, you could tell there was a great deal of training behind how he was managing to do what he was doing, and people experienced in firearms, experienced in military capabilities were saying the same. On Australian television and elsewhere, almost immediately those images came out. My thoughts when I heard about the Philippines element here, and again, this is an early investigation, but we do know of the characteristics that do exist, whether it's attached to this case or not. We know the characteristics of some of the characteristics anyway of radicalization, of jihadi violence, of Islamist, political Islamist violence. We've seen it here on the streets of London. We've seen it in the arena in Manchester. We've seen it in many places here in the UK, that kind of extremism. And we've seen it against Finsbury Park Mosque, let's not forget, as well, where an elderly Muslim man died because of far-right extremism as well. And I include that because whilst it's important to discuss anti-Semitism, and we absolutely are going to do that again today, I think central to all of this is identifying the enemy, isn't it? And the enemy is extremism and extremists. The enemy is not your Muslim neighbour, your Jewish neighbour, your English neighbour who takes pride in Britain. That's not your enemy. Your enemy is extremism and extremists. And I think that's important. But I was remembering all the way back to 2005, sorry, July the 7th, the aftermath of which led Tony Blair, Prime Minister at the time, to say to us, look, this is going to be a generational struggle. And I remember when he said that, thinking, what does that mean? What does that mean exactly? You know, in detail, in terms of what does that mean? And I think over the years, we've started to get a picture of what that means. But I wonder whether you think we take ISIS, Boko Haram, any other kinds of extremism, Islamist extremism, thinking of the Bondi case, do we take it seriously?